Yeah, okay, great. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here tonight to bring you some revelations, so to speak. We've been asleep for many, many years, and it's time now for us to wake up. And it's time for us to wake up, not in fright, not to look around and jump back from the shadows, but to come awake with our eyes open, realizing what stands in front of us and what we must do so that we can live our lives again in peace and tranquility. And we must, at all costs, guard against drifting back into the slumber that we have been in for the last 40 to 50 years. That has really created the situation that we find ourselves in today. We're going to be discussing a lot of subjects tonight, and I would like for you to hold your questions until the end, at which time I will be happy to answer them. The harder the question, the more I like it. There's no such thing as a dumb or stupid question. And while I'm imparting this information to you tonight, I want you to try to come up with questions to poke holes in it. And I'm going to answer every one of those questions, because when you leave here tonight, I don't want you to have any doubts in your mind whatsoever about the truthfulness of what you're about to hear. Because it is so important not only that you understand it and believe it, but that you act upon it, so that we can do something about it. We tried to get a large television set tonight, and lo and behold, in the entire city of Sedona, this is the largest we could get. So if you'll bear with us, I'm going to be showing you some videotapes. Most of them we're going to play through once, because the audio will be enough for those of you who aren't able to see it from the back. When I get to the Kennedy tape, if you are unable to see what you need to see, after we play it the first time, let me know. We will then ask the people in the front to stand up and move back, and those of you in the back come forward. We will play it through as many times as we need to. It is important that you know that you've been lied to, that your own government assassinated one of our presidents. And we're going to show that to you tonight. I would like to thank some people now and talk about some material that you're going to be seeing here in the future. I would like to thank especially Eve Bruce, who through long distance telephone conversations really started this rolling and was the one who put it together for you. I would like to also thank Mr. Ed DeMar, who was sort of in partnership with Eve to bring this about and did an awful lot of work on it, and who has written a book called Lese Majesty. It's by Ed DeMar, and it covers or concerns a lot of the material that I'm going to discuss tonight, and a lot of the things that Colonel James Bo Greitz is talking about across the nation. I have read a good portion of Mr. DeMar's book this morning, and I have to tell you, it is one of the most in-depth, most well-researched, most well-referenced works of its kind that I have seen, and includes the best bibliography on this subject, which is available for all of you here tonight. You can pick up this bibliography from the table back here, and the reason we put it out for you to pick up is because most of what I'm going to tell you tonight, you can find out for yourselves through your own research. Most of the information that I'm going to give you is not secret. It has been in the public domain for many years. However, we have been extremely trying to think of a nice word for it, but I can't. The word is really negligent. Asleep. We have abdicated our role as the watchdogs of our government. Instead of reading, instead of questioning, we watch television, we believe everything that Dan Rather tells us, amongst others. He is just one. There are many, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that later, who lie to you every night on the 6 o'clock news and the 11 o'clock news. So that we get started off on the right foot, I'd like to preface my talk with something I think you need to hear to put you in the proper frame of mind and keep you, I hope, from becoming afraid. Fear is a worse enemy than any other thing that we have to face. Ladies and gentlemen, the world needs to hear the truth. It's long overdue. The world also needs more peace, compassion, and cooperation. We already have too much fear and confusion. And too many people are feeling hopeless and victimized. What is offered here is startling information. And what we ask is that if you choose to accept it, you do so with the understanding that it would not come to our attention now if we did not have the ability to successfully respond. But successful only if we bring our highest thoughts, energies, and feelings to take positive action. We are not here to create more confusion, fear, or negative energies of any kind. And it is important that we not give in to these in ourselves, as it would only add to what the world already has. Fearing and fighting is the old way. We've tried to change the world, and the result has been that those who managed to be the victors brought the same constrictive and negative patterns back into power. We have now come to the threshold of a new understanding, that we must fight fear with confidence, hatred with love, separateness with unity, and beliefs of being a helpless victim with the acknowledgement and acceptance of the power we have to create our own lives and then the world. It can only go in that order. For if we are still creating confusion and negativity in our own experience, we can only contribute that to the world. We can change the world. But it will not be by outward action alone. To the extent we can bring truthfulness, compassion, and peace in our own lives is the exact extent to which we will bring them into the world. This does not mean that we have to sit in our rooms until we perfect our own lives, but to realize that if we see ourselves as victims, we will be victimized. If we perceive part of the world as separate, wrong, or evil, that is exactly what we will have. This story was beautifully played out in Star Wars. Luke had to gain his own inner power first by his belief in his connectedness with all things, and could only succeed in battle by not giving in to negative feelings. The problems that have arisen in our world have come as a reflection of our own collective fears, beliefs in separateness, and refusal to accept our own power and responsibility for the events in our lives. If we give in to these same feelings again, the battle will be lost before it is begun. Now, I want you to bear that in mind. I want you to bear in mind that what has happened over the years, we bear a major part or portion of the responsibility. And it is up to us, in the abdication of others, to correct the situation, to correct it. We are powerful. each and every one of us is worthy, is powerful, has great potential to change the world. If you look back through history, you will find at least 27 incidences that I can pinpoint where one man or one woman has changed the entire world. So if you doubt your ability to successfully act and change the world, I challenge you to re-examine that belief, and I challenge you to stand up, take action, and I guarantee you that you will be amazed at the power that you really, really have. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm talking about tonight began many years ago, 250 years ago to be exact. This is not something that has happened overnight. This is not something that's going to go away overnight. But it is something that we can begin to work on, and we can make major changes before the end of this year. And before the night is over, that is going to be my challenge to you and my commission to you, is to help us bring about those changes. And I'll tell you exactly what those are. I'm going to brush over the brief history of this, because what I want to do is get to the meat of the matter that's happening today, because that's really what concerns us. But you need to know how it all started. About 250 years ago, there was a man who was contacted by, you might call it a channel, you might call it an alien being, you might call it a spirit, whatever you call it. This entity that contacted this person set in motion one of the most far-reaching, longest-lasting conspiracies known to man. It began with the Illuminati. It began with the Illuminati right from the inception of the Illuminati as a plot to depose the rulers of the countries of the world, take down the national barriers, create a one-world government with the core members or executive members of the Illuminati at its head, concentrating the power of the world and the wealth of the world in their hands and subjugating the rest of the human race literally to serfdom. When the heads of the monarchs of the countries of Europe uncovered this plot accidentally, they immediately banned the Illuminati. They put a price on the head of the members of the Illuminati, and they quickly disappeared and took to the holes in the ground. They were sheltered by other secret groups. You will find that all of the secret societies that are concerned with this particular conspiracy, all through the years, always have levels of initiation for their membership. I'll explain to you why that is a little bit later. This is really a European thing, but it has spread to the United States. The major controlling membership of these secret societies is a group known as the Round Table of Nine. They are the heads of the most powerful banking families in the world. When you get right down to it, there are only nine families who control the wealth of the world, and that is the nine families whose heads make up the Round Table of Nine. Beneath the Round Table of Nine, there's an international organization known as the Bilderbergers. The Bilderbergers are a major player in this. Beneath the Bilderbergers, each nation has its own group. most of the European nations look to the Club of Rome. In the United States, it's the Council on Foreign Relations, and in recent years, in our generation, the Trilateral Commission. You may not realize this, but they are one and the same. The Trilateral Commission branched off from the Council on Foreign Relations to give you something to hang on to should they lose political power. It is an old ploy. It's the same as in the playoffs for Major League Football. You have two teams and you play yourself. You cannot lose. That is the theory behind the split. Now that you know a little bit of the history, and not too much, because I really want you to go start reading for yourself, and you will find that there's plenty of material to give you food for thought, a lot of hours of reading, and a lot of productive research. Our story really started in around 1936, when Germany recovered a flying disc. It is not clear whether they entered into an agreement with the aliens and were given the disc, or whether they took the disc, or whether the disc crashed and they just came in possession of it. The method by which they did this is not clear. It is clear, however, that they had a disc as early as 1936, that they were attempting to duplicate the technology in an area known as Peenemünde. When we went into that area after World War II, and captured Peenemünde, we found safes, file cabinets, drawers loaded with documents on the alien technology and on the attempts to reproduce the technology. We found pieces and portions of hardware. We found some of the scientists in our sweep trying to recover them. Many of them, however, were captured by the Russians. Much of the hardware was also captured by the Russians, and the Russians may have captured the original disc, because we certainly didn't get it, to my knowledge. Notice I say to my knowledge, because I was not privy to every scrap of information. When we found this at the close of World War II, we were extremely concerned. We didn't know what to do about it, but we immediately set the scientists about working on trying to duplicate the technology, or at least come up with it on our own. Most of it we did not have to duplicate until 1947, when, as you probably read or heard, or recently if you watched Unsolved Mysteries last Wednesday on television, you saw what was described as the Roswell incident. The Roswell incident is a true incident. It did occur. It occurred near the city of Roswell, New Mexico. And what actually happened, there was a thunderstorm. A disc was seen flying over two cities in the direction where the wreckage was found. The disc either exploded in the air or hit something in the air. But whatever happened, we know it happened in the air, because debris was found in two different locations. There were large amounts of small debris scattered over a ranch that belonged to a Mr. Brazel, who was an old-time cowboy. He was a very honest man and reported it. Several miles away, there was a large, intact majority of the saucer, actually, or the disc, found on the ground with several dead alien bodies. The reason I say several is there are accounts that there were four. I saw pictures of three of those dead alien bodies in a report called Project Grudge, which also included material from a report called Blue Book Report Number 13. So, I'm not sure whether there were three or four. I saw photographs of three of those bodies for sure. Really, it doesn't make any difference if there was one or 50. The important thing is that it occurred, and that there were dead alien bodies that were not of this world. The technology was not of this world. We could find nothing within that craft that we knew anything about. We could not find electrical wires, we could not find vacuum tubes, we could not find hydraulic actuators, accumulators, control valves. We didn't know what made this thing tick. Immediately, it was classified secret. It was carted away. The press was told, first, that they had recovered a flying saucer. Second, that no, it wasn't a flying saucer, it was a weather balloon. When the local newspaper tried to put it out on the wire service was interrupted, and a message came across the wire to the local news service stating that they were to cease transmission immediately. What they were transmitting concerned the national security. The message was from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And this is documented. The witnesses are still alive and have so testified to this fact. What happened over the next several years, really that's the most important thing that initially happened. The second most important thing that happened, and there were other crashes in between, the second most important thing that happened is that we found two disks in the vicinity of Aztec, New Mexico in 1948, which contained human body parts. Now, this caused the classification to go from secret to way above top secret, because there was a great fear of a national panic. Now, this was before they ever did a study to determine whether or not they believed the populace would panic if the information that aliens here were here was disseminated. But they knew that if they told the public, or if it got out to the public by some means, that aliens were not only here, but were flying around in craft which contained human body parts, that's another story altogether. Now, I don't want you to get real concerned about this, because your chances of being affected by it personally are extremely remote. The next really important occurrence was the fact that in 1949, again near Roswell, two disks crashed. They recovered five alien bodies from these disks, and in combing the area to make sure that they had recovered all of the wreckage and everything that they could so that the public would not be able to discover anything, and so that they would have everything with which to gain knowledge and technology from, they scoured the area by foot patrol, by jeep patrol, and by aircraft reconnaissance, and discovered an alien live from the crash wandering in the desert. They captured him. He was designated EB, extraterrestrial biological entity. EB was taken to Los Alamos, where he was placed in a Faraday shielded environment. Because he had the ability to read the thoughts and transmit thoughts to people outside of where he was being held captive. He also had the ability, through a device that he wore around his waist, to literally walk through walls. Now, we know through our own study of science that this is not far-fetched. We know that mass or matter is made up of molecules, which are made up of atoms. And in between these atoms, there's quite a large space on that scale. And in between the molecules, there is a large space on that scale also. It's much like being out in space and looking at the solar system. If the sun and each of the planets, if you were to consider them to be molecules, if you could get way down microscopically and look inside your own hand, you would see much the same thing. There are large spaces between them. They're held together by a force or an energy, which we know very little about. With the proper technology, you could literally put your hand through your other hand if you knew how to do that. The aliens apparently do, because they can not only walk through walls, but they are apparently able to abduct you from your bed in the middle of the night and lift you out through your ceiling without opening any doors, without lifting the roof, without opening any windows, and you pass right through it with no ill effects, and they can put you right back down in your bed in the same manner. Now this sounds totally insane, doesn't it? Doesn't it really? Because I have to tell you, quite frankly, when I was reading this material, and when I was studying the abductee reports, and when I first came across this, I thought it was crazy. I thought it was insane, until I realized that it was absolutely real. I want you to also bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that it was not too long ago, and it really wasn't too long ago, that if you mentioned to someone else that in a few years man would be flying through our own atmosphere, you would have been laughed at, ostracized, and probably kicked out of town. Then not long after that, when we did have aircraft and were carrying passengers flew through the air, if you had suggested to your neighbor that in a few years a man would be walking on the moon, you would have been laughed at, ridiculed, and maybe run out of town. Literally, when we put a man on the moon is when I realized that nothing is impossible. Nothing ever again can be impossible. The next most important thing that happened after they found E.B. came a few years later. E.B. became ill, and they tried to save him. They were unsuccessful. They didn't know how to go about it. But in an attempt to save him, and also in an attempt to gain favor with this technologically superior race, they began broadcasting out into space for help. We have one of your people here who crashed in one of your ships. We're trying to save his life. He's dying. Please help us save his life. By doing that, they hoped, number one, to make contact, number two, to make friendly contact, number three, that the aliens would see us as a benevolent people trying to help one of theirs and would not attempt to destroy us or hurt us. Because we realized that their technology was so far ahead of ours that in any military confrontation of any kind, we would have had no chance whatsoever. And basically that is still true today. What should give you good feelings is that if the aliens wanted to, they could have done anything that they wished to us many, many years ago, and they have not done that. So I see that as good. Hopeful. I see it pregnant with all kinds of hope and possibilities for the future. Because we know as the human race, what we usually do to an inferior culture if we're technologically superior is usually not that good. So there is a great deal of hope. There's a great deal of promise in that. E.B. died in June of 1952. As of the time of E.B.'s death, we had not had any answer to the message that we had sent out into space. The movie that you saw called E.T. is the story of E.B. They have changed some things around to make it more palatable to you. The beginning of the story, he's running around in the desert. He's lost. The government is chasing him. In the real story, the government caught him. In the movie, the little boy gets him. And they form this symbiotic relationship. They're each getting something from the other. And it's a wonderful story. Well, in real life, the real life E.B. was assigned an Air Force officer to watch over him, become his friend, get as much information from him as he could, be his mentor, be his captor. And the same symbiotic relationship developed between E.B. and this Air Force officer, to the point where when E.B. died, the Air Force officer cried. He was deeply hurt. He'd lost a dear friend. because he had been with E.B. literally night and day since they had found him. In the movie, E.B. gets very ill, and everybody's very concerned. And the little boy plays the role of the Air Force officer. And you see that he cries. But in the film, he lives. E.T. Call Home was Project Sigma to attempt to make communications with the aliens to come and help save the life of E.B. The government, ladies and gentlemen, is giving you information at an unprecedented rate every day. They are trying to get to your subconscious and tell you the story of what has happened over the last 44 years. So that when the truth comes out, it is not a critical shock. You will be prepared for it. You will understand what is happening. In 1953, we detected large objects in space coming toward the Earth. They took up a high orbit around the equator. These objects were determined to be spacecraft intelligently controlled. We did establish communications with them. Arrangements were made for them to land. There were three landings in 1954. One took place at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. One took place at Edwards Air Force Base in California. The other one, do not hold me to this because I cannot substantiate it, but I believe it was at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. I believe that the aliens who contacted us, who were attempting to help us, who refused to give us technology, who wanted to help us with our spiritual development, I believe that that landing took place at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. But I can't get any verification from that from any source, so don't put that down as fact. Put it down as a possibility. The other two bases, the other two landings, I know occurred without a doubt at Holloman Air Force Base and Edwards Air Force Base. The first landing occurred at Holloman Air Force Base, where the aliens met with our intelligence officers. They reached a basic agreement after several hours. They were able to communicate. They left one hostage with us. His name was Krill, as a pledge that they would return and formalize an agreement. Later in 1954, they landed again at Edwards Air Force Base. President Eisenhower had arranged to be on vacation in Palm Springs. At the appointed date and time, President Eisenhower was whisked away. He actually disappeared. Nobody even saw the helicopter come or go, but he just flat disappeared. The press was really shook up. And if you read the newspapers during that period of time, you will find that the press literally went wild trying to locate him. They were given a story that he was taken to a dentist for a toothache. They never found a dentist that treated President Eisenhower. In fact, he was at Edwards Air Force Base. He reached a formal agreement with the aliens and a treaty was signed. This was played out in a movie that you saw called Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Everything that you saw in that movie, except for finding the ship in the desert and the plains in Mexico and those types of things, was true. People were and are still being abducted. People were and are still being picked up and relocated, decontaminated, brainwashed, given new identities, and put back into society in some other location. It's for their own protection, really, in most cases. In some cases, it's a travesty of justice. People are being implanted. The implants were played out by the silly little tune that people got in their head. That represented the implants. They couldn't get this out of their head. They would have a close encounter with an alien disc, and they would hear this tune, and they could never ever get rid of it. And it drove them to do some crazy things. And there are people today who are being driven to do some crazy things. I know some abductees who wake up one morning after they've had an abduction experience and they've got to move. and they've got to move to a specific place in a specific state, and they've got to do it right now, and they don't know why. And they've never been there before, and they have no friends there. They don't even know what the place looks like, but they get all their kids, they pack up, and they leave, and they go to Sedona, Arizona. Some of them go to Yelm, Washington. There are areas in the United States where people are being driven to. They don't know why they're going to these places, but they're going there. Usually they have been abducted. Usually they have been implanted. Well, let me take that back. I guarantee you that everyone who has been abducted has been implanted. And the time that I saw the information between 1970 and 1973, the official Office of Naval Intelligence figures was 1 in 40, which works out to 2.5% of the population. How did they get these figures? Very simple, ladies and gentlemen. At that time, they still had the draft. At that time, they had draft quotas from every state representing a certain percentage of the population. A certain percentage of the population of young men had to be drafted according to the percentage of the total population that lived in that state. When they came in for induction into the military service, they were given an extensive medical examination, and even at that time, ladies and gentlemen, we did have magnetic resonance imaging capability, but the military did not put it out to the civilian community as yet. This was a new technique, a new development. They found that according to the number of implants they found in the military inductees, based upon the percentage of the population of that state from which they were taken, that the number of people in the United States who had been implanted was 1 in 40. I sincerely believe that that was an underestimate, maybe a large underestimate, simply because now today most of the abductees are women, and that sampling was taken from only men. Why they're mostly women, I don't know. It has something to do, I do know, and this may not be the only reason, and that's why I say I don't know what the whole reason is. It has something to do with the attempts for them to preserve their race in an attempt to crossbreed with human beings, either as a direct attempt by implanting or impregnating the female and allowing the baby to come to the first trimester, at which point they're abducted again and the fetus is removed, or by harvesting sperm and ova from selected human beings and attempting to grow this crossbreed in the laboratory. There is tremendous evidence to support this. Now, let me digress back again to the next major step that happened, was that in 1954, when President Eisenhower became incumbent with the office, he realized that he was going to have to deal with this, and he also realized, as I realized a long time ago, you can't believe what's happening. You can't believe what the aliens tell us, whether they be good, bad, etherical, interdimensional, whatever. There is so much deception and so many lies involved with this that you have to step back and say, I'm not going to believe anything until I can prove it. And to do otherwise is to put yourself in terrible jeopardy. Believe me, terrible jeopardy. And I can cite instances where this has happened. President Eisenhower knew that he wasn't capable of determining what the truth was, but he knew that there was some pretty smart people in this country. He put together an organization called MJ-12, or Majority 12. Majority 12 was made up of 6 men from the United States government. Those 6 men were Nelson Rockefeller, who represented the president, who was the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the director of the CIA, the director of the FBI, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The balance of MJ-12 was made up of the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, it is extremely significant that you understand that the first six members from the government, along with President Eisenhower, were also members and longtime members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They believed in that organization. They believed in its goals, which was one world government. Now, secretly, this was known as Majority 12. It was called MJ-12 in correspondence. When they addressed correspondence to each other, they did not address it to MJ-1 to MJ-6. It was J-1 to J-6, because secretly they were known as the Jason Scholars amongst themselves. Publicly, they were known as the Committee on the Clear and Present Danger. And to my knowledge, may still be known as the Committee on the Present Danger. I remember MJ-12 as being 12 men. However, I am still in the process of remembering, and my memory is constantly being joggled and jiggled. And one of the reasons I may have remembered it as being 12 members on Majority 12 is that they had to have a majority of 12 votes to carry anything into action. Thus Majority 12, thus Operation Majority, thus the Majority Agency for Joint Intelligence. That's where that name really came from. Which means they literally had to have the vote of every member on it if there were really 12 members. But having to have 12 votes to carry, being named Majority 12 or MJ-12, could have just been enough to make me believe that they only had 12 members. My memory is beginning to joggle now, and I'm starting to believe that maybe there was first six from the government and 12 from the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations, and that there may really be 18 members on MJ-12. Whenever I believe that a correction needs to be made, first, I wasn't going to do this. But that's wrong not to do that. It's wrong to stick to your guns because you don't want to change anything. That's silly. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't make any difference if there's one member, if there's 12 members, or if there's 18 members. What makes a difference is that Majority 12 exists, MJ-12 exists. These men were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they are the secret government. That's what really counts. Now, I'm telling you this tonight, there may be a discrepancy in the number of members because I haven't confirmed it yet. But I know that there were at least 12. Everything else that I've told you about them is absolutely true. But there may just possibly have been as many as 18. When President Eisenhower put this group together,
oh, thank you.
I didn't realize how thirsty I was. When he put this group together, this group, and President Eisenhower may have done this intentionally, but there's no reason to believe that he did, because there's nothing to tell us that he did. But having been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he may have done this intentionally. These people saw this as the opportunity that they had been looking for all of their history. It was the opportunity, finally, to control one of the major superpowers of the world behind the scenes. Because who gets knocked off when things go wrong? The person standing out in front, right? The people behind the scenes just chuckle and laugh and say, they got the wrong guy, and they put another one right up there for you to knock off. If you're even smart enough to knock somebody off, which we haven't been. The only ones that have been knocked off, they did the knocking off. through a whole bunch of secret executive orders and NSC memos, which are in fact executive orders, they reached the habit actually of using NSC memos in place of presidential executive orders to prevent the government from falling should the public find out what was really going on. It was to save the presidency. What started out as a means to save the presidency resulted in a means to prevent the president from knowing the truth. Up until President Bush, President Eisenhower was the last president who knew the entire truth. And when he left office, he could see what was happening. He was a very intelligent man. He could not have been the overall commander of all Allied forces in Europe with 5 stars and then reached the office of president if he had been a dummy. He was not Dan Quayle, I can guarantee you. He knew what was happening, and he attempted to warn us when he left office. He told us, quite bluntly and in no uncertain terms, to beware of the military-industrial complex. And who is the military-industrial complex? It is the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and since the inception of the Trilateral Commission as well. The Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission control the board of directors, the majority of the stock, and usually the president and CEO of all the major corporations in the United States of America, including the news media, the major publishing interests, etc., etc., etc. Usually the president and CEO is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and are the Trilateral Commissions. Many of them have dual membership. The Board of Directors is always controlled. Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission members own the majority of the stock. Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, which, by the way, the Rockefeller family owns the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, believe it or not, own the majority of the stock in the major corporations in the United States of America. They own the majority of the American-held stock of the Federal Reserve, but the majority of the stock of the Federal Reserve is owned by the European bankers. America has been sold right out from under our noses. It doesn't belong to us anymore. It belongs to a secret government, a secret worldwide government, which pulls the strings, which says, we want this to happen here, and it does. We want this to happen here, and it does, invariably. These men are playing a game of chess on a level that we have never imagined. They're playing chess with the world. And we don't know how to do that. We can't even conceive of that. So let's not be concerned with the world. Let's just be concerned with our country, because they cannot succeed with the world if they cannot succeed with the United States. And with your help, they will not. Where do the aliens fit into this? I've told you the most important incidents that have happened. Everything else is really trivial. I've told you about the abductions, the implants. I've told you about the mutilations, the body parts being found on the craft. I've told you about the agreement. I've told you that they're here. I've told you that we have their technology. Those are the important things. Whether they're at Area 51 or at Tonopah or down in Alabama doesn't make any difference. They're here. Invasion is over. It's all over. Don't look for an invasion from space. It has already occurred and is over with. So we don't have to be concerned with that. One of the things that the secret world government is going to attempt to do to get you to accept their new world order is they're going to try to scare the hell out of you with a fake phony landing where they're going to say, oh my God, there really are ETs, it's going to be covered by the media of the world. And they're going to say, we're going to be invaded from outer space, we have to band together as humanity to save the planet. And most people are going to say, yeah, yeah, let's do it, one world. Imagine all the people. Imagine nothing worth fighting for. Imagine no religion. Imagine living only for today. These events are always fun and unpredictable. I'll tell you what, it's time. Let's take about a 5-minute break. Came up and asked quite appropriately, who the hell are you? And I used to start all of my talks out with who I am, where I'm coming from, how I saw this information, and what my stance is on it. And I eventually reached a point, and I keep forgetting that I'm not in California anymore. I reached a point where people would say, we already know who you are, tell us what you got to say. So I stopped doing that. But now I'm in Arizona, and I realize that whereas in California I'm very well known, here I may not be as well known. I was raised in a military family. My father was an Air Force pilot. He is a retired Air Force colonel at this moment. When I was a child, I heard stories about Foo Fighters and crash discs and things not of this world and strange sights up in the sky, and saw pictures that pilots took simply because I was the son of a pilot. Not because anybody was taking the time to show me, I just happened to be there when these things were discussed and when these pictures were shown and passed around, and usually was underfoot and eventually was kicked out and exiled to the back bedroom or the backyard. Eventually, though, I grew up and left home, went into the Air Force. I was assigned to the Strategic Air Command as an aircraft and missile neutronic technician, which means that I worked on the hydraulics and the pneumatic systems, or high-pressure air systems, of aircraft and missiles for the Strategic Air Command. I worked with B-52 bombers, KC-135, aircraft, which is the same as a 707, only it's for refueling other aircraft and carries fuel instead of passengers. I worked on B-58 bombers. I worked on Minuteman missiles. During the time, both when I was in school learning my trade in the Air Force and the time that I was on the job, I met people who had taken part in crash disk recoveries, and usually at the Airman's Club or in some bar downtown or someplace, because I was a young man then and that's where you could usually find me with a beer in my hand looking for a girl. And if there wasn't a girl around, we lied to each other a lot. And generally these stories I thought to be a lie until later years when I realized that these guys had been telling me the truth, and I could kick myself in the head because I had not written it down. I had not pressed them for more information at a time when they were willing to talk to me for some reason or other. When I left the Air Force, I went into the Navy, and really I had planned to just skip from service to service. I was a pretty crazy young kid. I was gung-ho. I was raised on John Wayne movies and Sergeant Rock comic books. I came from a military family. My whole family was in the military service. Uncles, grandfathers, brother, everybody. We were service people. We were government people. We were patriots. We cared. We believed that the best thing that a man or a woman could do was to serve their country. When I went in the Navy, I volunteered for submarines because that was the weirdest thing you could do. And I was pretty weird. and I thought it would be neat to sleep underwater. So I did. While I was on submarines, being junior in the Navy, real junior, I had to stand lookout watches. Lookouts are well-trained professional observers. They are not just someone that they grab out of the galley and stick it there with a pair of binoculars. You are well trained, because before you yell to the officer of the deck that you got to shoot at something coming at you off the port beam, you got to know that that's really the enemy and not the admiral coming out for a visit. And that's really the main reason for it. So we were trained observers. Now this is extremely important to me personally, because without this experience I probably would not have lent the importance that the later information that I was going to see, I probably would not have realized how important it was. While on lookout between the Portland, Seattle area and the Pearl Harbor area, while we were traveling on the surface as port lookout, I saw a craft the size of an aircraft carrier exit the water at a range of approximately 2.5 nautical miles off the port quarter. The port quarter is approximately 45 relative degrees off the port bow. Port is your left. Left port wine is red. That's where the red light is on a ship. Okay, now we got through that. I was stunned. I knew that I had just seen something that was absolutely incredible, and nobody in the world would believe that I saw it and nobody else saw it. And I was faced with a dilemma. I'm the port lookout. Something just came up out of the water that could destroy us in a second. It was a machine. It was intelligently guided. I knew this. It was as big as an aircraft carrier. It was the most important earth-shattering thing that had ever happened to me in my life, because I saw it, I realized what it was, I knew I wasn't dreaming, there was nobody around who could be manipulating me in any way, shape, or form, and it was my responsibility to report this. Are you kidding? I'm going to tell the man who writes my performance report that I just saw this thing come out of the water? You got to be nuts. But I had a responsibility to the safety of the ship, the boat, which we call submarines boats, not ships, to the boat and to the crew. So I had to devise a method to report this. And what I did was I told the officer of the deck, Ensign Ball, I said, Ensign Ball, I saw something about 2.5 nautical miles off the port quarter, but it just flashed and I don't know what it was. Could you please help me scour that area to see if we can find it again? Now, I didn't really believe that this thing was going to show up again at all. Well, the starboard lookout heard this conversation, and he turned around and started looking too, which he shouldn't have done, because you're never supposed to desert your own field of responsibility, but he did. At about that time, the object came, or this object, or another one just like it, came back down out of the clouds and entered the water. Ensign Ball dropped his binoculars, dropped his jaw, and turned around and just stared at me and didn't say a word. And then he turned back around and he just stared off into space for a couple of minutes. And then he turned around and looked at me again. And he said, this had to happen on my watch. He then called the captain to the bridge, which on any naval vessel means that there is an emergency in progress. You do not call the captain to the bridge unless there is an emergency situation, unless his presence is needed. If you call the captain to the bridge and his presence is not needed, you are in deep, deep, deeper than the submarine will dive to, trouble. And it's lucky they didn't have submarines in the old Navy when they killed all the people. Now, the captain came to the bridge, and so did the chief quartermaster, because it was his job to come to the bridge with the captain with a 35-millimeter camera anytime anything like this happened. This event repeated itself several times over a 7 to 10 minute period, and we watched it. They would exit the water, go and disappear in the clouds, and then another ship, or the same ship, would re-enter the water. Eventually, it stopped. We were told by the captain, before we left the con, the bridge, not to discuss it with the other crew members, that it was classified top secret, and that we were never to mention it to anyone. Now, the crew knew about it. How they knew about it, I don't know, but I suspect that it was picked up on sonar and radar also, in which case the sonarman and the radarman would know about it too. And I believe that is what has happened, and I believe that they were also told not to talk to anyone. But several crew members came up to me and wanted to know if we really saw a UFO, and I told them that I was not allowed to discuss what happened, and I didn't know what I saw anyway. So that was the end of that. I did tell a good friend about it years later. When we arrived in Pearl Harbor, a officer from the Office of Naval Intelligence came on board and debriefed each one of us independently of the others. I do not know what went on in the debriefings of the other personnel involved, but when I went in, he began to ask me what I saw. When I began to describe to him what I saw, he became very upset, even enraged. And having come from a military family, having a father who was an Air Force pilot and an officer, having served 4 years in the Air Force, I knew what this man wanted to hear. It was obvious to me. So I told him what he wanted to hear so that I didn't have to go through with what I knew I would have to go through if I told him anything else. So I told him, "Sir, I did not see anything. I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "That's the spirit." I had to sign a security oath. I was dismissed, told that I was a good sailor, had a good future with the Navy, and I left. On the way out, Seaman DiGirolamo was braced up against the bulkhead in the passageway, and I whispered to him, "Tell him you didn't see anything." And I don't know whether he did or not, because we never talked about it again amongst ourselves. Several years later, I was trained again. Well, in between this, I struck, or striking is what you call trying out for a certain particular job. I was striking for quartermaster, which is navigation. It's where you navigate whatever ship or vessel you're on. I made it, was promoted to third class quartermaster. Eventually was promoted to second class quartermaster. I was then trained by Naval Intelligence in my secondary NEC, which is 9545, which is internal security. I was then sent to Vietnam, where I was given a multi-million dollar patrol boat. I was given five other lives to take care of and mother and be a friend to and be a daddy to and everything else, and was given a river and everybody that lived on both sides of that river and said, "Bill, go out and kick their butts. And while you're out there, try to collect as much intelligence as you can, try to learn as much as you can from the local people, try to make friends with them, keep the river safe and secure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." While I was there, I learned that there was much UFO activity in Vietnam, an awful lot of UFO activity. They were called, in official reports, helicopters, enemy helicopters. Well, anyone who knows anything about Vietnam, if you look in documents released about Vietnam under the Freedom of Information Act, you will find many reports of any enemy helicopters attacking our troops, attacking the enemy's troops, taking villagers away from their villages. The truth is, ladies and gentlemen, North Vietnam had no helicopters, period. It was really UFO activity. When I came back to the United States, I was assigned to the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet and was specifically assigned to the intelligence briefing team for Admiral Bernard Clary, who at that time was the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet. While serving in this official capacity, I had occasion to prepare briefings on flaps. You know what a flap is? I mean, something's happening right now, and it's very important, and everybody's concerned about it, and all the admirals are in the command center, and they want to know what the hell is going on, and they want up-to-date information, and they want the plots correct, and they want to know who's over here, and what's the closest ship, and how fast can we get a United States Marine unit there. That's what you call a flap. In other words, everybody's throwing it all in the fan, and it's all coming out on me and the other people who were with me. It was our job to provide this information on a 24-hour basis. And specifically every day, we would come in very early in the morning, about 4 a.m., and we would prepare a briefing which took place at between 8 and 9 o'clock whenever the Admiral was ready, because we didn't tell him when to be there. He told us when he was there, and when he was there, we had to be ready. Between 8 and 9 o'clock, usually, we would present a briefing to the Admiral and his Chiefs of Staff. Now, you have to remember that this man had reason to know what was going on in half of the world, because he's literally responsible for the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean and everything in between, including the land masses. In case of a nuclear attack or nuclear war or any kind of a war, it is the United States Navy that will deal the primary blow to the enemy, will deliver the war to the enemy first, and will usually carry it through to the end. And that is the truth. So he had the need to know everything that happened in that part of the world. When alien-connected incidents occurred, we would get top secret messages marked MAGIC, restricted information. That is not an obsolete security classification. And the first time it was used was not in the Nixon years. It has been used on alien connected material since the beginning. So don't believe everything you hear. When we got these messages, usually all hell would break loose. It was of the utmost importance. When we were briefing officers who were new in the position that they had the need to know regarding this flaps, we sometimes had to brief them on the history that led up to this incident. So then I had access to documents containing the history. Until eventually, I found in my hands a document called Operation Majority and another document called Project Grudge, which contained the most astounding information I have ever seen in my life. And from that day forward, my life has never been the same. It has not been normal in any way, and I wish that it had been somebody else who had seen the information. But because no one else has had the guts to stand up and talk about what they've seen, I'm kind of glad that it was me, because I do have, and I will continue. Because you need to know what was in those documents and what's happening. Now, if I had not seen the UFO with my own eyes first, I would have thought that this whole scenario that I saw in these documents was a hoax. Not perpetrated by the Navy or the Office of Naval Intelligence or the United States government to fool me or to fool anybody else in the Navy. I would have thought it was a hoax after I had read Operation Majority that outlined the plans for the secret government, the secret world government, to come into power. I would have thought that it was a hoax to scare you into bringing that about. And I still think that they're going to use it to try to bring it about. And I want to warn you beforehand not to believe a word they tell you when they tell you there's going to be an invasion from outer space, because there's not going to be. It's already taken place. Because I saw what I saw on board that submarine, and because of the research that I've conducted since then, I know that it's real. It's not a hoax. It's not something to propel this world government into position. It's real. There's aliens here. They're just as real as you and I. and I'm here to tell you about it. And there are other people talking about it, and there have been throughout the history of this thing, only, especially in the early years, anybody who tried to talk were killed, were sent to mental institutions, just flat disappeared, and they never knew what happened to them. Or all of a sudden, Joe Blow was working in a garage, and now he's got a nice job in the government, making three times what he was making in that garage, and he doesn't talk to you anymore. Those things were commonplace. They have still been commonplace up to the present time, except in recent years, people are starting to learn how to prevent it from happening. And one of the ways is you get squarely in front of the public and you stay there. Because I'm going to tell you this right now, and you can bank on it. You watch me every day of my life. If anything happens to me, you don't have to do any more research. You know damn well everything I'm telling you is true. And they don't want you to know that. So they're not going to touch me unless they can make it look like an accident where you will believe that it's an accident. And I'm telling you right now, they know how to make people die of heart attacks, strokes, brain hemorrhages. They know how to make people fall down the stairs. They know how to make people commit suicide, or at least look like they committed suicide. And if you don't believe that, look at what happened to the 20 material witnesses who were close enough to the car to see William Greer shoot President Kennedy within 2 years of the time it happened. They're all dead. The odds of them all being dead is something like 300,000 trillion to one. Some of them apparently, I say apparently because that word means that's what it looks like, committed suicide. One died of a karate chop to the neck. Several of them had heart attacks, etc., etc., etc. One man hung himself. They were all murdered, all of them. They were murdered by the Central Intelligence Agency. William Greer was the assassin who killed President Kennedy. He was a Secret Service agent. I'm going to show you the film here shortly. Many of you wonder, well, if that's really true, how come Jackie Kennedy never said anything? If the Secret Service, the highest protective body in the United States assigned to protect the President of the United States, just shot President Kennedy, who in the hell is she going to tell? Me? I can't do anything except tell you. The FBI? J. Edgar Hoover is one of the men who ordered his assassination. He was a member of MJ-12. You beginning to see the picture? The picture's not a pretty one. What has happened is these men who throughout history have been trying to figure out how they can control the world all of a sudden discovered how they could do it. In 1952, President Truman, together with the heads of state of the European nations and the Soviet Union, formed what is known as the Bilderbergers to coordinate the international efforts to protect the world from an invasion from outer space should these aliens turn out to have that as their ultimate goal. The Bilderbergers, as MJ-12 did, soon learned how to wrest power behind the scenes and use the world banking families to manipulate and leverage these nations so that they are really in control of the world, and they are headed by the 9 heads of the families that own most of the wealth of the world, known as the Round Table of 9. Under them, each nation has a group of men secretly controlling that nation. And I don't mean every nation in the world, I mean the nations that count, the hard currency nations, have an organization which is a sister organization to MJ-12 within that country's respective government. How does this work, you say? how can a secret organization such as MJ-12 control the government? It's very simple, ladies and gentlemen. If you will remember, that President Eisenhower formed this secret group in 1954. He was the last president who knew everything. They began in 1954 to issue secret executive orders in the form of NSC memos to wrest power away from the president and effectively isolate the president. They took the power to appoint appointees in the government away from the president. And if the president wants to appoint someone whom they don't want him to appoint, they have a way of embarrassing the president to get him back into line, or getting rid of him altogether, or making sure that he doesn't get elected if he's not willing to play the game. The result has been, ladies and gentlemen, that today every major member of the United States government is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, or the Trilateral Commission, but usually the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. They usually have dual membership. Every one of them, not just a few. You see, it started off in 1954, there were just a few. Truman's years, there were hardly any. Eisenhower got in, he was a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, he appointed some. After that, when they took the power to appoint on themselves, they told the president who to put in those positions, and that's who got those positions. And today, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission is the government. The government is not representing us. They are representing the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and the Secret World Order. Please, when you go out of this room, look it up yourself. Because if I hear from you that you don't believe it, I'm going to say, did you check on what I said? Did you go to your library? Did you pick up the bibliography that we left for you on that table? Did you go read those books? If you tell me no, I don't want to hear what you have to say anymore. Because I can bring you a message, and I can tell you what that message is. I cannot march into battle by myself. I will be literally creamed. You must be beside me as I march, as Colonel Bo Greitz marches, as John Lear marches, as Bill English marches, as any of the other true patriots in this country are marching to try to clean up our government. Because we can't even begin to deal with an alien force, because we don't have the power to make treaties. We don't have the power to make agreements. We don't even have the power to sit down and hold a discussion. We do have the power to get rid of the ones who are not representing us and put people in who are representing us and demand that the crooks be prosecuted and get thrown in jail. We have the power to clean up our government so then our government can represent us, and then we can deal with an alien question. So what I'm telling you tonight is forget about the aliens, because you cannot hope to deal with them until we clean up our government. Once we clean up our government, then we can deal with the other problems. Until then, we cannot. Because you can't make a treaty for me, and you can't make a treaty for her, and I can't make a treaty for any of you. It takes our government to do that. Now, I want you to understand, I do not and never have advocated the overthrow of the United States government. I advocate the restoration of the United States government to its legal and proper place as our founding fathers laid out for us to follow. I advocate and will march and defend to the death the restoration of the Constitution of the United States of America. Because the Constitution of the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen, is the United States of America. We are not the United States of America. The state of Arizona and the state of Mexico, or New Mexico, is not the United States of America. All of the states and all the people together are not the United States of America. The United States of America is and only is the Constitution of the United States of America. That document is the only thing that keeps you free. That document is the only thing that gives you freedoms and guarantees them. That document is the only thing that keeps people from taking your freedom away from you, along with one of the clauses that they gave us in that document, which was the right to keep and bear arms. And I know that that issue is controversial, but let me explain to you why it is in the Constitution. In history, all throughout history, when a despot or a conqueror or a wicked person wanted to subjugate the people, if the people were unarmed, it was easy for them to do that. In fact, it was a foregone conclusion. The only thing that has prevented that from happening in the United States is the fact that most Americans throughout our history up until recently have always had at least a .22 rifle in the closet. And no one could ever successfully march against an armed population which believed in themselves. We've lost a belief in ourselves. We've lost an understanding of the Constitution. We've lost the meaning behind it. We don't understand what our country is. We don't understand what keeps us free. And the secret government is manipulating you daily into begging them to take away your freedoms. And some of you here in this room have been begging them to take away your freedoms. You've been asking them to take away your right to keep and bear arms, which is the only thing that keeps them from destroying the Constitution, declaring martial law, and forming this world order right now. The only thing preventing that is the guns in our closets. That's all, because they would have done it years ago if it had not been for that. Many of you right now in this room have been screaming for the government to take away some of our freedoms in order to get the drugs off the streets. You've been saying, I'm willing to give up some of my freedom to get rid of this terrible plague. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it is your government who imports those drugs and who is selling those drugs to your children, and has been from the very beginning. And the only ones that they ever catch or allow to be caught are those who are in competition with them. This operation was put into place in the late 50s. It was organized by George Bush in cooperation with the CIA while he was president and CEO of Zapata Oil. Their plan was to bring the drugs in from Central and South America to the offshore oil platforms of Zapata Oil, from there to bring them into the United States by the normal crew conveyance and helicopters. Therefore, they would not have to undergo inspection by custom officials or law enforcement agencies of any kind. And it's been going on ever since. Today, the drugs do not enter this country by the little planes that they would have you believe on the 6 o'clock news, nor by the little boats that they say are speeding across the Caribbean. The Coast Guard, ladies and gentlemen, and the United States Navy are not inept. Every aircraft that approaches the borders of this country from any direction is monitored minute by minute by the North American Air Defense Command. The drugs, ladies and gentlemen, are brought into this country on CIA proprietary contract aircraft and military aircraft, and land on CIA facilities in the United States, and on military air bases, and Homestead Air Force Base is one of those bases where those planes land. Recently, Colonel James Bogreitz, in the last few years, went to the Golden Triangle area to try to bring back American prisoners of war who we know are still being held. We've always known it, the government has known it. They have misused the Officer of Prisoner of War, the Office of Prisoner of War Accountability to transact these drug deals. So they don't want the prisoners of war to come home. Well, we didn't know that until Bo Greitz went over there and talked to a gentleman by the name of General Kunsa, who is the drug overlord of the Golden Triangle. I've talked extensively with Colonel Greitz about this. I have all of his information. And coupled with mine, it paints a very bad picture. General Kunsa says that every year, government agents, high-level government agents, are purchasing 800 tons of pure heroin and shipping it into this country from him. He wants to stop it. He is willing to stop it. He wants us to give him a crop substitution program so that his people do not have to raise poppies and process heroin in order to survive. He wants to become a recognized real nation rather than an illegal group of bandits living in the jungle. And George Bush and the United States government says there is no interest in doing that here. He's willing to stop 800 tons of pure heroin from coming into this country every year. And George Bush says, we're not interested in doing that here. Furthermore, we're not interested in hearing who these government officials are that he says he's selling these drugs to. Furthermore, Colonel Bo Greitz, if you don't shut your mouth, we're going to lock you up in a federal prison and you're never going to get out. And they tried. You see, it was the United States government that sent Bo Greitz to Southeast Asia to bring prisoners of war back. Colonel Bo Greitz is the most decorated man to come out of Vietnam and one of the most decorated heroes that this country has ever had. They sent him in there because of that, and they gave him a lot of press. And every time he went in, they warned the enemy beforehand, usually by Radio Free America, in their own language, warned them by name who was coming, how they were coming, what route they were going to take, so that they would not be successful. But it made the administration look good because they were sending somebody over there to do it. But every time he went, he had to use a phony passport that the Department of Defense gave him to use to accomplish his mission. So I'm going to show you a short tape right now, and I want you to pay a lot of attention to this, please.
April 18, 1989, what many Americans regard as the most important trial in the United States, began with little fanfare in Las Vegas, Nevada federal court. Although it was well covered by the local media, in stark contrast to the Oliver North trial, the national print and broadcast media were conspicuously absent. It was almost as if an invisible dome had descended over Las Vegas to prevent any satellite uplink from reaching the rest of the nation. For nearly 2 years, Lieutenant Colonel James Bo Greitz had been under indictment for misuse of a passport. The charge had been leveled at Greitz as a result of a trip he made to Burma in 1986. U.S. government prosecutors have contended that Greitz lacked official sanction for his activities in Southeast Asia in pursuit of American POWs and missing in action. Greitz, one of the most highly decorated Green Beret commanders of the Vietnam era, has countered that he has been so charged in order to shut him up about his discovery in the Golden Triangle headquarters of General Kuntsov that high-level U.S. officials and intelligence operatives have been actively involved in massive drug smuggling for over 20 years.
And the financial support was controlled or given by Richard Armitage, who said he stayed in Vietnam at the time. And after the Vietnam War, Richard Armitage was a prominent narcotic personnel, prominent trafficker in Bangkok.
In Bangkok,
yeah, after the Vietnam War.
Countless attempts to place this evidence before Congress and the national media have been met with responses ranging from polite rebuffs to outright refusal. Repeatedly during the course of preparation for the trial, the three successive U.S. attorneys prosecuting the case stated that they would drop the charge if any evidence of official sanction for his travel had been presented. Although Greitz had offered testimony from several witnesses, including U.S. officials, verifying this, the judge attempted to exclude such testimony in preliminary hearings, even to the extent of issuing a gag order. To most knowledgeable observers of the case, it had become very clear by the start of the trial that this was indeed an official effort directed at the highest levels of the U.S. government to railroad Greitz.
We think that Bull Greitz is right, and that these charges against him are unjust. American hero.
The government says this case isn't about politics or foreign policy, but Greitz and his attorneys are trying to prove otherwise.
I'm glad to get the facts before the public. It's not me on trial here. It's the government and their drug smuggling, and it's the prison war issue. And it's been me who's been wanting to get this thing over with.
During opening arguments, Greitz's attorney, Lamont Mills, told the jury he won't dispute the government's charges. Mills admits Greitz did use a false passport when he returned to the country in late 1986, but he says the real story is why he did it. Greitz maintains the government sent him to Southeast Asia on a mission to find POWs, but the White House and the Pentagon deny any involvement.
I wanted to go to trial because this story needs to be told. I felt through a jury trial, a public trial, that the plight of the prisoners of war might be focused upon, and government involvement in drug smuggling to promote covert operations that Congress will not approve of should be focused upon.
The U.S. attorney says the case is not about politics, but about the simple misuse of a passport.
Hey, look. I got better things to do than talk to Deer Can Commandos, I can promise you that.
What's your reaction to the government calling you a Deer Can Commando?
Tonight? And I'm proud of the uniform of the United States. And anyone that say that, obviously, you can't say the same.
Hillary Reed-Ray, Bob Wright, has been acquitted on charges of using a phony passport. In federal court this morning, Judge Philip Crowe said he had no choice but to toss out the case. He says the government charged Greitz under the wrong statute.
Former Green Beret is the federal judge has thrown out a felony passport charge against him. Federal Judge Philip Crowe dismissed the case against Greitz today, saying the government simply brought the wrong charge. Greitz says he's pleased with the judge's decision, but that he still has a story to tell about what's going on in Southeast Asia.
It's not over until the prisoners of war home. It's not over until Richard Armitage is investigated and this government drug business is exposed. It's sweet and sour. No one likes to win a victory because the enemy fouls out. You don't even get a chance to take the field. George Bush called me up and told me.
Such comments by a United States attorney following nearly 2 years of persecution of Lieutenant Colonel Bryce and the expenditure of many thousands of taxpayers' dollars are alarming. If Maddox's statements are true, the implications are profoundly disturbing. As the Iran-Contra scandal continues to unravel, revealing President Bush as more than a willing participant in numerous illegal activities, his direct interference in this case would seem to be a distinct possibility. Such behavior by our chief executive and his legal representative in the state of Nevada compromises our judicial system and violates long-cherished standards of American jurisprudence.
The government apparently hasn't given up on trying to convict Bo Bryce. The grand jury is now apparently looking at brand new charges. The government is still after Green Beret Colonel James Bo Bryce. A federal grand jury has subpoenaed samples of Bryce's handwriting. Yesterday, illegal use of passport charges were thrown out against Bryce because the government filed the wrong charges. Today, word leaked out that the grand jury had taken up the Bryce case again, and that the Bryce attorney, Lamont Mills, was hopping mad.
It is unethical. It is childish. If that's true, that breaches everything I know about the grand jury process. It shows someone who's embarrassed and humiliated because they did it wrong and their case was thrown out of court. If a man is guilty, let him come in with an indictment and let us go to trial and establish our case. But to release things to the press, when you just started an investigation, violates everything I know about the grand jury process in this country and the Constitution upon which it's founded, and I'm mad.
I wish I would have been able to present to the public exactly why they charged me. I was told that I would serve 15 years as a felon. I was promised aggravated charges and hostile witnesses if I did not agree to cover up what I found in Burma in 1986 and 1987. I'm going to be about finding prisoners of war. They won't prosecute me for that. They're certainly going to have the chance.
Can we have the lights, please? I think I missed some. What was it the federal prosecutor said on the courthouse steps? It's important that we covered that segment of this talk because it leads directly into something that I'm going to cover next. The purpose of the importation and sale of illegal drugs to the American people was to finance the alien-connected projects and other black projects which they knew they could not take to Congress for funding. For two reasons. One, everything they were doing was illegal under the Constitution and Congress could not, in all ethical and moral standards, approve those projects or approve funding. The second reason was they believed, and with some rightfulness, that if they told Congress, it would be the same as telling the public. What happened next, or a few years later, is a profound significance. It is one of the most heinous crimes that this secret government has ever committed and ranks, in my estimation, right alongside the sale of drugs to our children. And that is the assassination of the President of the United States. There have been three presidents who have left office directly because of action of MJ-12, one of them by murder, assassination, however you want to dub it, it's all the same thing. President John F. Kennedy found out somehow that the CIA was behind the drug smuggling and the sale of drugs to the American people, and if you'll remember correctly, that was the years that the hippie movement began and the flower children began to come out. And they were looking for answers because they were disillusioned And one of the answers where they found solace was drugs. And President Kennedy was a very idealistic man. I think when he took the presidency, he fully intended to play the game until he discovered the weight of the position and the importance of the position and the trust that the American people placed in the president. And I sincerely believe that he and his brother sat down and decided that that was going to be the first honest presidency. They attempted to get rid of corporate crime, organized crime. He attempted to do things right. He was idealistic. He was charismatic. The people followed him. They loved him. We still love him. What happened to him was a terrible blow. I was sitting in a barracks. I had the, what you call the watch. And part of the watch was so boring that I was actually watching television. And what I was watching was the Kennedy motorcade in Dallas, and I was on an Air Force base called Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. And what I saw was a man whom I believed in with all my heart, struck down in the street by hail of bullets in a most undignified manner. And I cried, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. The tears came out of my eyes, and I couldn't stop them. And I felt a great emptiness in my chest, and I knew at that moment that the world had changed and would never again be the same for me. And it never has. But I didn't know then what I was to learn later. What I was to learn later, as I read in documents prepared by the Office of Naval Intelligence, and how did they know? Because they had a part in it. President Kennedy was ordered to be assassinated by MJ-12 because he had discovered that the CIA was importing and selling drugs to our children, and he ordered them to stop it. And he told them, if you don't stop it, you're going to be sorry, because I'll stop it and you'll all pay the price. Well, they didn't like that. They knew they would lose a lot of money. They knew they would not be able to accomplish their objectives. The second thing he told them is, I want you to implement a plan to reveal the presence of aliens on this earth to the American people within the following year. They didn't like that either, and they thought it was premature. They had already done a study which indicated that the American people would panic, that the panic would lead into anarchy, which would cause the collapse of the government, that our religious structure would collapse, that a large segment of the people would begin worshiping the aliens, that our economy would collapse, the stock market would collapse. They had doom and gloom and dark clouds for everything. I don't believe that will happen. And it certainly, in my estimation, did not justify the murder of the President of the United States. The murder was carried out in Dallas by teams which consisted of the United States Navy, which was to take care of the body, make sure that the autopsy was done in a manner that would not disclose the true facts. The body was kept under surveillance and custody of the United States Navy the whole time, was taken to a naval hospital. Most of these people involved were attached to naval intelligence. It involved Division 5 of the FBI, who was training people, assassination teams, to go into Cuba and assassinate Fidel Castro. It involved the Secret Service. And the CIA. When the long-range shots missed, and there were many more shots fired than anything that you've heard before, Kennedy was struck by a bullet in the back, which exited through his neck, or excuse me, was struck in the front of the neck, which exited through his back, I'm sorry. Governor Connally was struck with two separate shots. Another shot hit the windshield of the vehicle and broke it, and you can see that in the films. And we have blown these frames up many times, and we have studied it for countless hours. And we have put it together with the information that I saw in the documents, and we know exactly what happened. We know that Governor Conley was carrying a gun. And when he was hit, he started yelling, "Oh my God, they're going to kill us all." And as he turned around in the blow-ups, you can clearly see him reach into his jacket and begin to take out a pistol. And then you lose sight of what happens with that pistol. It may have been the shot from his gun that hit the window, but we don't know that for sure. We do know that the passenger, Secret Service agent by the name of Kellerman, I call him Killerman, during the motorcade, when you blow the frames up, you can see him watching Kennedy through his rearview mirror on the right-hand outside of the car. You can see it clearly. He's sitting there, and his eyes are watching Kennedy in that rearview mirror the whole time. When Kennedy is struck in the throat, he watches for a few more seconds, then he turns around, he verifies it, he turns back to the front, he passes something to the driver, who is William Greer. They seem to converse for a second. He then goes back to his position. William Greer then glances, then Kellerman leans over, takes the wheel. William Greer pulls with his left hand, pulls up, and you can see it clearly. He pulls up a pistol, turns, and over his right shoulder shoots Kennedy directly in the head. Kennedy's head then snaps backward. Jacqueline Kennedy looks at her husband. You can see her eyes go from her husband and look directly at William Greer, and then she attempts to get out of the car. She is afraid. Throughout all my combat experience, that is exactly what you do. You run away from the fire, not into it. What you see in the John Wayne movies is BS. I never saw one soldier ever run into a machine gun. You run away from the machine gun, and then you figure out how to get that machine gun next. You don't just run up there and die. That's for the Marines. If there are any ex-Marines in the crowd, I certainly do not intend to slight you. The Marines are probably one of the bravest group of men that we have in this country. However, how they ever get the courage to get out of a small boat and run up on a beach and die so that someone else can run up behind them and lay down and use that body for cover, I will never, never know. But they do it, and that's to their credit, because we wouldn't be free if they didn't. But anyway, that's what prompted that remark. I've seen this happen, and it amazes me. What happened next was that both men in the front seat hunched down. The car speeds up out of sight. During the time when William Greer is actually shooting Kennedy, the car comes to almost a complete stop, which is exactly what a driver would do if someone else is holding the wheel and he's turning around to shoot someone. You would remove your foot from the accelerator. We have tried this, and it's exactly what people do instinctively. They don't even think about it. It just happens. The film that you normally view when they show it to you on television is speeded up many times, so that everything happens real fast. You're always looking at Kennedy. You don't even detect that the car slows down, and you never look at the driver, so you wouldn't see it anyway. But just to take a precaution, they cut a few clips out there, so even if you did think to look at the driver, you still wouldn't see it. But in the film I'm going to show you tonight, we got those clips. Now, when I saw those documents, it said in the documents that the act was plainly visible in the film that was withheld from the public. Not too long ago, on the Ted Koppel late night thing, I forget what you call that. What's it called? Nightline, that's right. Ted Koppel, in answer to all the controversy, the new controversy about Kennedy's death, assassination, said, oh, but there was only one film taken in Dallas. He lied because he knew that there were three. Everyone knows that there is three. There's three in the Warren Commission report. He intentionally lied, knowing that most of the American people will take his word for it without even checking, and if they thought it was three before, will think they were mistaken, not Ted Koppel. Ted Koppel is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Stop listening to the nightly news. They're lying to you. The best thing that you can ever do is turn your television off or burn it, or give it to little Johnny who has a screwdriver and needs something to play with. What happened next is they took the body to Parkland Hospital in Dallas. It was illegal to remove the body. No autopsy was taken there. The doctors were ordered by the FBI and were actually interfered with. They were told not to attempt to determine the path of the projectiles through the body. They were told to get the body ready for shipment as quickly as possible when it was determined that they could not save Kennedy's life. There was no investigation done in Dallas at all. The doctors did draw sketches of what they saw, and they did make reports of what they saw immediately following and during the incident. Now, if you understand the human mind and you understand the way the legal process works, those reports are legal documents and should stand up in any court of law or any investigation, because they were done at the scene by professionals who were qualified to make those determinations. Photographs were even taken, but the photographs taken at Parkland Hospital disappeared, so that there was only the doctor's reports and the drawings left. The body left Parkland Hospital in an ornate bronze casket, was taken to Washington, D.C. Somehow, the body got out of that casket on the aircraft, and we know exactly how it was done. When Jacqueline Kennedy was taken forward to participate in the swearing-in ceremony of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the naval intelligence officers removed Kennedy's body from the bronze casket, passed it down into the baggage compartment, where it stayed like a sack of potatoes until they landed in Washington, D.C. When they landed in Washington, D.C., we have tracked down someone who was on the other side of the plane who also took a film of a military helicopter, a naval helicopter to be exact, or I should say a marine helicopter, but that's part of the Navy, landed on that side of the plane near the galley door, and something was taken out of the plane and put in that helicopter, which we now know was Kennedy's body. It was flown to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and it arrived there a full 30 minutes before the casket, which left Parkland Hospital, arrived there. President Kennedy's brain was removed, and another brain that was undamaged was substituted in its place. Why? Because if they had performed an autopsy on the brain that was really actually President Kennedy's brain, they would have found that he was hit from the front, that it was an exploding pellet and not a bullet, and they would have found fragments of that pellet, and they would have found large amounts of toxic shellfish poison in the brain, which was exploded into the brain when this pellet did its thing. And it would have said, CIA, 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 because the CIA had that type of weapon at that time, and it was well known. When they finished doing that, they surgically repaired the wounds to make it look like he was hit from behind, and then they took photographs of these repairs. Then they took the body in to be autopsied as if it had come out of the bronze casket. They also altered the throat wound. We know this. Kennedy's brain was taken out of the room where all this occurred on a gurney, covered with a cloth, And when people asked what that was being wheeled down the hall and the gurney covered with the cloths, because everybody wanted to know what the hell was going on, they were told that a woman had delivered a stillborn baby, and that was the stillborn baby. It was not. It was Kennedy's brain. Checking the records and doing thorough research, we have found out that there was no stillborn baby in Bethesda Naval Hospital on that day, or the day before, or the day after. Witnesses ask what the other casket was doing in the room. They were told that an Army colonel had died and the casket was prepared for him because he had died that day and the family had requested a quick burial. Checking the records, an Army colonel had not died in that hospital. In fact, no one had died in that hospital that day, and an Army colonel had not died in that hospital for some time. I don't hold much hope for William Greer talking, but I want him to talk. I don't want him killed. I want that man to talk. I want him to become a man and talk. I want the rest of these so-called men and patriots in our government to become real men and real patriots and start talking. Because right now, I'm going to tell it in front of you, I'll tell it in front of the world, I'll tell it in front of the government. Our top military commanders are cowards and they are traitors. The men who represent us are cowards and traitors, and they're all afraid to talk. They're scared to death to talk. They'll let the country go down the tubes before they'll stand up and do what a man should do and what our history demands that any man who calls himself a patriot do: stand up and talk and tell the truth. And I'm going to continue, and I'm going to ask that you continue with some of the things that I'm going to ask you to do tonight when you leave here over the next few days and into the next year. I'm going to ask you to continue until we clean up this government, until it gets back to a government of, for, and by the people. Now I'm going to show you the Kennedy assassination tape. I want you to watch it very closely. And if you can't see it, we'll run it again. And if you still can't see it, we'll run it again. I don't care how long it takes, because you need to know this. You need to know who killed your president, and you need to know why. And you need to be incensed, you need to be outraged, you need to know that you have the power to do something about it, and then you've got to do it. You have to do it. And I'm going to give you this challenge. If you can't do it, you ought to go live in another country.
Years ago, the people of the United States and the world were shattered by the impact of an assassin's bullet upon the helpless, unsuspecting young president of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Watch the driver, not Kennedy!
The bullets has penetrated deeply into the body and soul of America, destroying the very lives of thousands and the heart and trust and political will of literally millions. And the years that have passed since this tragic event removed from the world stage perhaps one of the most promising human agents of peace and progressive political development, we have been fed one officially sanctioned lie after another, beginning with a blue ribbon cover-up commission to a castrated Senate Select Committee seeking to shed light upon an event deliberately enshrouded in deception, concealment, and outright falsehood. 25 years is long enough. It is time the truth was finally told, in the earnest hope that it will truly set us free of the murderers who pose as our protectors.
observing here is the motorcade in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. As the presidential car passes behind the freeway sign, President Kennedy is struck in the throat by a bullet that was fired from the grassy knoll. As he's grasping his throat, John Connally turns around to his right. He, at that point, is struck. You notice the driver, or excuse me, the passenger of the car turning back to see what has happened to the president. As he turns back to the front, the driver of the car turns with his left arm over his right shoulder with a pistol and fires. You see the 45 automatic, 45 caliber, nickel-plated automatic weapon in his left hand. He's firing over his right shoulder. You see it in relief. You see his head pointing backwards towards the president. And this enhanced close-up.
Watch her eyes. She looks right at Greer.
Of the bullet upon the president. The force of the shot drives him violently backward against the back of the seat. You see Miss Kennedy react in horror. The ugly gaping wound, which is evident here, according to many observers at the scene, was actually created on the print. This was not the actual nature of the wound. But you notice that Mrs. Kennedy wasted no time in trying to exit the vehicle, because she clearly was able to determine exactly where that shot had originated. And it was her personal bodyguard, Clint Hill, another Secret Service agent, who attempted to keep her in. What the arrow was indicating here is what appears to be the outline of a man, a hat, and his rifle. The arrow is pointing to the rifle barrel of the man in the bushes who possibly was the rifleman on the grassy knoll who fired that shot. Another view taken by another photographer. Again, you see Mrs. Kennedy trying to exit the vehicle from behind, being pushed back in by her bodyguard. Number of witnesses on the scene rushing towards the vehicle. This section, the man standing on the far right of the wall there is Abraham Zapruder, the photographer who took the original photos. And the arrow here is indicating what was very likely the rifleman on the grassy knoll, the man who fired the shot which penetrated Kennedy's throat from the front, not from behind, as the Warren Commission would have you believe. Very interesting note also that the motorcycle policemen were told to remain behind the car at all times. Here you see the passenger in the front turning back, looking at the president. Instead of jumping back to assist him, he turns forward. The driver is now rotating. The weapon comes into view and he fires. You'll see this repeatedly in these sequences. Kennedy's been shot in the throat. He's leaning to his left. The driver now begins to rotate. His left arm comes over his right shoulder and he fires now. Again, you see the driver rotate. You see the weapon coming into view. He's rotating again. The weapon is in view. He fires. You can clearly see his head turning and his arm and the weapon extending into view over his right shoulder. Many of the witnesses indicated that the car slowed almost to a virtual halt at about this point. And here in the normal version, you see how much more quickly to speed it up. It's much harder to determine. Many of the people who asked the question why Jackie Kennedy did not report this, it should be fairly evident that she wasted no time in getting away from the attacker.
Lights, please. Did everybody see it?
No.
Okay, those of you who did not see it, please come up to the front. And would some of you in the front not see it? Okay, good. Let's move right on along here now. What I'm showing you here is an aerial photograph taken of Area 51, otherwise known as Dreamland or Groom Lake. It is a super top secret area in the Nevada test site where we are test flying the alien craft. Now, a lot of people didn't believe what John Lear and I have been telling them for a long time. And there is a radio show in Las Vegas called The Billy Goodman Happening. Is there anybody here who listens to that? One gentleman in the back. Did you hear the Groom Lake trip?
Yeah, every once in a while.
Okay. What happened was is they didn't believe what we were telling them, and all these people wanted to go out and see for themselves. So they put together this trip to Groom Lake. Now, in anticipation of this, a reporter from Santa Clara came down, got a grant from a radio station up there and came down and camped out up there watching Groom Lake for a week in advance and phoned in reports every night to the radio station. And he had dozens of sightings. Unmistakably unidentified flying objects that could in no way, shape, or form be aircraft. All in the Groom Lake facility, in the air, doing things that are impossible to do. On the fateful night, 100 of Billy Goodman's listeners and Billy Goodman and about 9 members of the Lincoln County Sheriff's Department went up there and had a vigil. They had 4 sightings, and then the majority of the group left. 4 good sightings, and then the majority of the group left. 12 people stayed there all night and had 15 more documented sightings that they are ready, willing, and able to swear to. So, you can do with that piece of information whatever you wish. I suggest that those of you who can tune in to the Billy Goodman happening every night, Sunday through Friday night at 10 p.m. It goes from 10 p.m. till 1 a.m. in the morning. It is the only radio show, in fact, it's the only media in the world that accurately reports the UFO issue. I have been a guest on there many, many times for the whole 3 hours. He has had Colonel Bo Greitz on there. He has had Brad Steiger on there. He will have anyone on there who knows anything about this and wants to be on. All you got to do is write him or call him, talk to him. His daytime number is area code 702-451, and I hope you're writing this down, Virgil. 702-451-3131 in the daytime. If he's not there, please leave a message for him. He will get back to you.
What is the name again?
His name is Billy Goodman.
What is the frequency?
It's 840 on the AM dial. Now, I've tried to get it on my car radio here. That station is 50,000 watts, and it's heard in Canada. The whole state of California can hear it, Oregon, Idaho, all over the place, but I can't get it on my car radio in Sedona, Arizona. It's incredible because it is the only... Billy Goodman, in my estimation, is a hero because everyone else who has ever tried this in the past has lost their job or the radio station has blown up or something has happened. But Billy Goodman has sworn that he's going to persist until the truth comes out. So he will talk about it every night. He talks about other things, and he has other guests on, and he has entertainers on, and things like that, but his main issue is the UFO and the drug issue, and he wants to get to the truth. And he has sworn that he will persist until the truth comes out, and nobody will make him stop, and I believe him. He's doing an absolutely wonderful job. Now, what does all this mean? It means that the secret government is not our government, and it is in full control and is powerful enough to assassinate a president and get away with it. They were powerful enough to tell Lyndon Johnson not to seek another term, and he didn't. How many of you have ever read or know anything about Lyndon Johnson? Anybody in here?
He was my teacher in school.
What did you learn about him? You think he would have not run for another term? This is one of the most ambitious men that ever lived. He was a politician's politician and one of the dirtiest of them all. And he wanted it all. He didn't run again because he was told by MJ-12 not to run again, because for him to run again and make a reversal on a Vietnam policy would have embarrassed the entire administration and could not have been explained. They needed to get another president in who would pull the troops out of Vietnam, because Vietnam was becoming an issue that was going to pull the government down. And Johnson was for finishing the war, not pulling out. President Nixon was forced to resign. The Watergate incident was created. Deep Throat was not one person, it was 3 people. The Washington Post is owned, and the editors all belong to the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, I don't mean owned by the Council on Foreign Relations as a body. It's owned by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. If you think that Bernstein and Woodward broke that story all on their own and their persistence, you better think again. They were led through that by their nose. Nixon was forced to resign. Nixon did something wrong. He did several things wrong. One, he opened up China. China had been isolated intentionally by the Soviet Union and the United States to prevent them from reaching a level of technology that would increase the pollution in the atmosphere and in the water of the earth. He did some other things, too, that they weren't too fond of. President Reagan's assassination, we believe, was an attempt to get Bush into office quicker than what he would have, and also to ensure that he got into office, because an election is always an iffy matter, and Bush had been their baby from the beginning. What can we do about this? Let me tell you what we can do about it.
I think we misunderstood something.
What?
Did you say Reagan's assassination?
No. Attempted assassination. Reagan, the attempted assassination on Reagan. Well, we might have missed something. I mean, he really wasn't alive for the last couple of years, was he? What can we do about this? It's very simple. This secret government may have control of the executive branch, but I guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, you have control of the Congress, the senators and the House of Representatives, because you're the ones who elect them, and you're the ones who can unelect them. You can impeach them. You can investigate their background and dig up all the dirt that lies behind every single human being that ever lived. And if you think that's not true, I'll prove it to you. I'll never tell anybody what I find, but I'll dig in your background and find something that would really embarrass you in the front pages of the papers. Because none of us are really without sin. So you can get those guys if you want to. You can play the same games they play. You can investigate their background and dig out that dirt and put it in the front pages of the newspapers. And you can cause them to fall that way. Another way is you can write them letters and say, listen, this is what I know is going on, and I want it stopped, and I want those responsible prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and if you don't do this, I'm going to do every single thing in my power to make sure that you never hold even the office of dog catcher in any city in this country. Now, you do have power, and you have friends that you can influence, and you can talk to groups as I am talking to groups, and we will furnish you information if you need it to do that. But this needs to be done. It must be done if you are to keep your freedoms, because they are going to take them away from you, and I guarantee you that. When the members of the Congress begin getting these letters, they're going to get worried, because that's their future. You're talking about their paycheck. You're talking about their life. You're talking about the security of their family. Now you're hitting them in the gut. Really in the gut. Then you have to follow through with it. You have to start putting pressure on them. You have to follow those letters up with phone calls, and you have to get your friends to write letters and your friends to call. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, if we start now, and if you, each one of you, can influence just 5 friends to do the same, and they can influence 5 friends to do the same, we can have those crooks on the carpet in front of Congress by the end of November. We can do that. You can do that. Now, This is not the time to be afraid that if you do it, you're going to get on somebody's list. You're already on their list. And you're not worth a barnyard chicken to them. You're already on their list. They don't care about you. They don't care about any of us. They will tolerate us as long as we are useful, and that is as far as they will tolerate us. When this one world economic organization comes into power, your Bill of Rights is going to be flushed right down the toilet. And if there's anybody in here who's working for the government and came to find out what I'm going to say today, I want to tell you that those are your rights also, and you're on the wrong side. And they will do to you just exactly what they did to Ollie North and Haldeman and Colson and Dean and anybody else who was loyal to them but became expendable to save themselves, because that's all they care about is themselves. Don't misplace your loyalty. Your loyalty belongs with the Constitution of the United States and nowhere else. It does not belong with me. I'm just marching into battle with you. Maybe right now I'm a little out in front. But believe me, when you start reading on your own and researching and looking into this, you'll run up here with me. I know you will. I have great faith in you. Americans have always been there when it counted. And if I didn't believe that in the bottom of my heart, I would not be up here doing this, because this is suicide without you. But I know you're going to be there. There's a lot of things you can do. You can research, you can write books, as Mr. DeMar has done. You can help in many ways. One of the ways that you can help is start teaching our children what the Constitution is, because they don't even know. And you know something? I'm not going to do it because I don't want to embarrass you, but you don't know either. Most of you in this room can't even tell me hardly anything about what the Constitution says, and you know it. That is the United States. It is our freedom. It is everything that we stand for. It is the only thing on earth worth protecting besides our family and our loved ones. There is nothing else to fight for. There is nothing else that has ever given anybody the freedoms and the chance and the opportunities that our Constitution gives us. And we must never lose sight of that. The Constitution has been taken out of the school books intentionally, ladies and gentlemen. The Rockefeller family owns most of the teaching colleges. Did you know that? They also own most of the textbook publishing companies. Did you know that? Did you know that the Federal Reserve is not an agency or a branch of the United States government, and our money is nothing but worthless printed paper? Did you know that when you pay your income taxes, you pay them to the IRS, which also is not an agency or a branch of the United States government? It is an agency of the Federal Reserve. It is the collection bureau to repay our national debt to those whom we borrowed it from. When you get your refund check, it does not come from the money you paid in. The money you paid in to income tax goes to the Federal Reserve to pay off the national debt. The United States government, to give you your refunds, has to borrow again from the Federal Reserve to give you your refunds, and we go more into debt. And did you know that if we started printing $100 bills right now with all the money printing presses that we have at our disposal, and printed money 24 hours a day, every day, forever, we could never pay off the national debt, because we cannot print the money fast enough to even catch up with the interest on the unprinted amount. Our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren have been bought and paid for and are in debt forever. And our nation is owned by the European banking interest, who own the majority of the stock in the Federal Reserve. We have been asleep at the wheel, and we are teetering now on the brink of a cliff. And one wrong move, we will go over that brink. But if we very carefully get out of this car and pull it back away from the edge of the cliff and get it back on a straight course to our destination, the true destination that we should be headed for, which is peace and posterity and safety and security and love and happiness, then we can survive. But as I said before, I cannot do it for you. I will march as far as I can until they strike me down. You've got to catch up with me. You've got to be with me, all of you, every one of you. If you go home and sit and think the rest of it will do it for you, then there may be somebody else sitting, thinking the same thing, and somebody else, and somebody else. And we might end up with everybody thinking that somebody else is going to do it for them. It's too late. It's too late. The Constitution of the United States and our freedom have never, ever been in greater danger than they are right now. We have never been at war with Russia. Russia is not our enemy. Russia has been our ally since the end of World War II, and I'm going to prove it to you right now. I'm going to show you a video that appeared on 60 Minutes last Sunday. And what did it say? How many of you have been reading in the papers that many of our generals and admirals and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of both countries have been going back and forth? Do you know what they're doing? Have you been watching what else has been happening in the world? They're taking inventory of the combined arsenals and getting ready to merge the two largest armies, navies, and air forces in the world to make this world government on the target date is 1992. The general says it to Mike Wallace right in the film that they have never considered the United States to be their enemy, and you might think it's propaganda. He was telling the truth. The reason for the guise of antagonism between the two countries for all these years has been to hide the fact and take the public's eye off of what was really going on. And the reason that they kept such large standing armies was, one, to fund large sums of money that they needed besides the dope money and everything else into these black projects, and to keep these large standing armies, navies, and air forces in case the Earth was invaded from outer space. It's all done in secrecy, still being done in secrecy. But over the last 10 years, they've been a little...
Next to Kubinka Air Force Base near Moscow, where the Americans got a close-up look at and a chance to ask questions about some of the aircraft they trained to fight against. Admiral Krau is still trying to get his Russian phrases straight.
How do you say thank you again?
Spasibo. Damn, I can't remember.
God. Size of that.
The highlight, a visit to the cockpit of a Soviet Blackjack fighter bomber, similar to the U.S.'s V-1. We listened over a wireless microphone the Soviets knew the Admiral was wearing as he and Air Force General Monroe Hatch asked questions.
And, what's the top speed?
Какая максимальная скорость полета?
2M.
2M.
2 Mach? 2M. And do you practice refueling with this?
Заправку в воздухе практикуете на этом самолете?
Нет.
No.
No.
What do you think, Monroe?
It's impressive. How many cruise missiles does it carry?
12 крылатых ракет. 12 welcome.
12.
But lately, the Soviets claim to have undergone a major change in their military strategy from emphasizing offense to defense. And they asked, how could their Blackjack bomber be an offensive threat with a range of only 2,200 kilometers, barely over 1,300 miles.
What kind of targets, then, are we going to use this plane? Within the range of 2,200 kilometers.
So I have a map.
Then General Moseyev made a remarkable statement.
We have never regarded the United States as the enemy of the Soviet Union.
And we do not regard
any possible scenario which would involve unleashing a conventional warfare or nuclear warfare, the most so against the United States.
You and I are literally members of a transitional generation, tasked at this moment to re-examine the way our two societies have thought.
Telling you the truth. How many of you saw the end of the Olympic Games in Los Angeles? Anybody? Anybody see it on TV or videotape or on the news? This incredible event, the most beautiful, authentic-looking UFO you ever saw, came down out of the sky and landed right in the middle of the stadium. It was awe-inspiring. It was beautiful. The crowd went wild. It was shining down the blue beams of light exactly as the abductees described them. It was an exact copy of the real thing. It was sponsored by Levi Strauss. How many of you saw the Levi Strauss Dr. Slacks commercial recently? Where the guy runs in and says, "Hey, guess what, gang?" He's got on Dr. Slacks. "America is hosting EBS." And the guy says, "EBS? What's EBS?" "EBS are extraterrestrial biological entities, and America is hosting EBS." And everybody says, "EBS, jeebies." He told us the truth, but we laugh at it. Not too long ago, Gumby on Saturday morning, your kid was sitting there and you thought he was watching good television. Gumby was abducted, implanted, and returned. And the little boy said, "I wish they'd do that to me." What do you think they're preparing those kids for? What else have you been seeing on TV? Alien Nation, who, by the way, look exactly like the group of aliens designated the Orange. How about War of the Worlds, which plays out the reality of John Lear's Lear hypothesis? What do you think is happening with ET, with V, which is telling us that maybe we may have to resist in just this manner if it ever turns out that one of these guys are bad guys? And what happens in V? The bad guys back a one-world government that takes over the world. And the world thinks it's wonderful, don't they? Until one lone CIA agent discovers the truth. And then people form little resistance groups. Well, gang, let's form them before it happens. Let's don't wait till it happens. Let's do it now. Let's prevent it. Okay? Thank you. There is a lot of supporting evidence that's out there. There are a lot of books. I suggest you read Whitley Strieber's book, Communion. I suggest you read his book, Transformation. I suggest you read his recent novel, Majesty. And I suggest you understand that the incident in there that he is describing is true, but understand that the formations in the government and the code words he's using are a part of a contingency plan called Majestic, and that he got the information from the research team of Moore, Chandray, and Friedman. Moore has stood up in front of the MUFON symposium in Las Vegas on July the 1st, 1989, and admitted that he was working for the United States government, that he had been recruited, that he was putting out disinformation to researchers to keep them from finding out the truth, that he participated in the TV show UFO Cover-Up Live, and at least 50% of it was disinformation. About 50% of it was true. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anything you see that says Majestic is disinformation and is a lie, the true name is Majority. Majority 12, Operation Majority. There is an agency called the Majority Agency for Joint Intelligence. Let me see if I got any other goodies to show you, and then I'll say a few final words to wrap it up. I think I do have some things that you might like to see. I want to show you how disinformation works. Not too long ago, when I first began talking about what I knew, John Lear asked me to come to his home for an interview with PM Magazine. I thought, wow, this is incredible. These people really want to put it on the air. I can't believe it, because it's never happened in the past. You see, there's always been an intense campaign of denial, ridicule, debunking, and character assassination. So I went there in all good faith, and John Lear and I, knowing what had happened to people in the past, took the producer and the camera crew aside, and we said, listen, this was about 8 o'clock in the morning. We said, listen, we'll do this provided one thing, that you submit to a complete briefing by each one of us on everything that we know and all the documents that we possess and the videotapes and the maps that we will show you and the letters that we have from officials of the government admitting that this is true, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They agreed to that. So we did it. We briefed them for approximately 8 solid hours with no breaks. When we were through, they were convinced, you see, because we presented the information to them without all the other comments like I'm making tonight, and for 8 solid hours of evidence, not talk, evidence, things that you can see and cannot doubt. And then they spent 4 hours filming us, John Lear and I. And we told them literally everything we knew. And this was for a 30-minute program, and she said, boy, this is going to be the greatest show in the history of television. And John said, you'll never get it on the air. And she says, they've never censored anything that I've ever produced, and everything I've produced, they put on the air exactly like I've edited it. And I said, well, I've got to agree with John. I really don't believe it'll air. Well, it aired. And what I'm going to show you is the results of what I have just told you. This is what aired, and I want you to watch it. And then you'll go back to your television set with a different kind of a viewpoint and a different knowledge, I hope.
Minority in this country who make the claim that we have been visited on a regular basis by extraterrestrials. Now, generally, they are dismissed as cranks or crackpots by most of us, but they persist in their belief that the aliens are with us. Some of these people, however, are a little difficult to dismiss, men like John Lear, who you will meet tonight. John says that he has had government connections in the past, and that the government is trying to discredit him because it's all part of a giant cover-up.
People are being abducted, not returned. People are being used for food. Aliens are eating us. They're experimenting with us. Horrible, unspeakable experimentations.
John Lear's is an unbelievable story. He's certain that we have been invaded by an alien culture, that they are experimenting on us, and that the U.S. government knows about. In fact, it's their most guarded, top secret. Began on a hot July night in 1947 when, according to Lear and others, an alien craft crashed on a remote ranch near Roswell, Mexico. Eyewitnesses, the local papers, even the first military men at the site reported a crashed UFO. Then, suddenly the top brass swarmed to the site. Witnesses were sworn to secrecy and every speck of debris was literally vacuumed from the dusty desert floor. A news story was issued. It, said military officials, was nothing more than a crash, but it was. William Moore has written a book on the Roswell incident.
We know that it was not a weather balloon. The people who gave out that story have since come forth and said it was nothing more than a fabrication to get the press off their backs. The evidence suggests it was a spacecraft, and the evidence suggests the government grabbed it and carted it away and is still involved in the examination of it.
In fact, government documents unearthed via the Freedom of Information Act suggests that both craft and alien bodies had been retrieved. However, references are vague and large portions of the text have been censored. What is known is that in 1947, the United States Air Force began a series of codenamed projects set up to monitor UFOs.
The truth of the matter is, since 1947, we have collected and have in our possession at least 30 to 35 extraterrestrial flying saucers. We have collected and have in our possession at least 100 to 150 alien bodies representing at least three different species that people are being abducted at an unprecedented rate.
Lear goes so far as to claim that the U.S. government has established communication with this alien power and actually collaborated with them. We have even built underground research facilities in top secret areas to house their little gray scientists. Now, says Lear, they have run amok. They are out of control and they are not benevolent. Our government realizes it made a horrible mistake and can do nothing about it. That it's not the aliens, but John Lear who's run amok, and he's outraged by his stories. Moore himself has spent years carefully and meticulously researching the UFO phenomena, proving he believes that UFOs exist, visit Earth regularly, and our government knows about it, and for unknown reasons is maintaining a massive cover-up. Stories like Lear's, he says, only discredit the truth.
John Lear called me up one time and was absolutely certain that he was about to be captured and eaten by aliens.
All I can say is my sources go right to the very top, and if it were not true, I would not be risking my credibility and my life to come forward with this information.
There is no doubt that Lear understands the inner workings of the U.S. intelligence community. He's the son of late aerospace pioneer Bill Lear, and for years flew covert missions over Laos for the CIA.
He has done nothing but collect the most outrageous rumor mill stories that are floating around on the grapevine.
Alien invaders, government agents, secret informants, hoaxes, or scams. A cover-up like no other? Is this science fiction at its finest or reality beyond our wildest imaginations? Has John Lear stepped off the deep end?
It's not important that you believe this now, but to file it away for future reference in a month, a year, maybe 2 years. We'll look back on this when the truth finally gets out and you'll say, my gosh, the son of a gun was right.
Well, I suppose anything is possible. John Lear, by the way, is not the only well-connected individual who claims to have had an encounter with a UFO. Michael Shea, a government lawyer, recently told his story of an encounter to the Washington Post. And then there's the Japan Airlines pilot who claims to have seen a UFO over Alaska last year and was able to actually draw a picture of what he saw. Coming up next, basketball buddies, Manu Paul.
Now, the reason you only saw John Lear, not me, is John Lear got all of his information secondhand from his contacts, where I was a firsthand participatory witness. Therefore, they didn't put me on, but they put John Lear on, and they put him on in a manner, after spending 12 hours with these people, this is what you saw. And this is how they do things. There is a campaign underway now to discredit Whitley Strieber. I can tell you that Whitley Strieber is writing about what really happened to him. I don't know Whitley Strieber. John Lear doesn't know Whitley Strieber. He's not getting this stuff from us, believe me. I have one other thing that I want to show you, which is about an organization called Yellow Fruit. Does anybody know anything about Yellow Fruit? Okay, let me show you this.
And he said, they're not in my league. And so he minimized
disclosure, minimize contact.
While Congress struggled to control KCCIA, another secret group operating out of the basement of the Pentagon escapes congressional scrutiny. Known as the Special Operations Division, or SOD, it was created as an anti-terrorist unit following the failed rescue mission in Iran. Much of what is known about SOD is because of the investigative work of this journalist, Stephen Emerson, who obtained thousands of pages of SOD secret documents through the Freedom of Information Act.
The Special Operations Division became the new center for intelligence and counter-terrorist activities in the Pentagon. In effect, it became a mini-CIA for the Pentagon, established in the basement, controlling half a dozen new counter-terrorism units. Names such as Sea Spray, Quick Reaction Team, Yellow Fruit, Intelligence Support Activity, heavily classified, to this day the Army does not acknowledge their existence, but all extremely capable, very aggressive in accomplishing their mission, the mission of fighting terrorism and guerrilla subversion around the world.
These units were ready to go anywhere and do anything. The mugging of Noriega in Panama, KGB cars in West Germany, the tracking down of a kidnapped U.S. general held by the Red Brigade in Italy.
They were all over the world, and they felt they had a mandate to be all over the world. After all, the CIA was a shadow of what it used to be, and the Special Operations Division was literally stepping into a void.
SOD may have been stepping into a void, but it was doing so with enormous resources. Tom Golden was in charge of financial control for a subunit of SOD called Yellow Fruit.
The funding was almost unlimited. I don't know of any time that we were in a position where we needed money. The money was offered and we had to find ways to spend it, basically.
In the fall of 1983, some units of the SOD participated in the U.S. invasion of Grenada. By then, the secret team's existence was known to National Security Council staffer Oliver North. It is believed that North, who worked closely with CIA Director Casey, quickly recognized how useful this super secret group could be to the CIA in Central America.
The SOD, located in the basement of the Pentagon, could be used to circumvent the legislative requirement that all covert operations be reported to Congress. Thus, the SOD could become a convenient vehicle to be used by the agency to conduct operations which it couldn't get approved, or in funding operations for which it had no money, like support for the Contras in Nicaragua.
One of the most severe and scandalous projects ever embarked upon in the U.S. military was a project called Yellow Fruit. It was a backdoor CIA effort to aid the Contras in Central America and to perform other operations that Congress never would have supported. And the CIA saw Yellow Fruit and the Special Operations Division as a magical fountain of support with unlimited money, unlimited weapons, black money, black tape transportation capability. Basically, another CIA without any of the reporting or problems that had triggered the problems of the late 1970s. Some of the units actually participated in strafing Nicaraguan targets, bombarding airfields and oil fields in an attempt to disrupt and possibly dislodge the Sandinista regime.
But Tom Golden blew the whistle on Operation Yellow Fruit.
Normally, in intelligence operations, you advanced a certain amount of money to operate with. Once you spend that money, then you must submit a voucher to account for it. What I found was very unusual in this unit is people had been advanced as much as $150,000 and had never submitted a voucher for accountability. I eventually went to my superiors and reported what I believed to be abuse of funds and possibly fraud. That eventually was surfaced to the leadership of the Army, who ordered a massive investigation into the special operations community in general.
This is Arlington Hall, Virginia, headquarters for U.S. Army intelligence. Here, members of the SOD team were court-martialed in a soundproof room. Two SOD members are now serving prison sentences for financial fraud. But what was most important about these trials was not the discovery of another case of misuse of government funds, but the revelation that the SOD's yellow fruit served as the blueprint for what William Casey called the Enterprise.
The Special Operations Division and Yellow Fruit had unique access to equipment, material, offshore bank accounts, a secret clandestine Army/CIA aviation unit, a clandestine ship overseas to provide transportation, access to material and weapons, all the seeds that would later basically erupt in the Iran-Contra affair and be known as the Enterprise. And I believe that Yellow Fruit and the Special Operations Division were both being groomed by the CIA and the National Security Council to serve as the cornerstone of the Enterprise to perform operations in Central America and elsewhere that would never be accounted to Congress.
Lights, please. Now, let me tell you who Yellow Fruit really is. Yellow Fruit, along with Sea Spray, are accountable for security of the alien task projects. They started out as Delta teams attached to the National Recon Organization at Fort Carson, Colorado. Over the years, as their expertise became known and they began to use Delta teams for other things also, they branched off and became independent from the National Recon Organization and from the United States Army. They then evolved into a split organization, one half of which became Sea Spray, the other half became Yellow Fruit. Sea Spray is responsible for the internal perimeter security of the alien projects. Yellow Fruit is responsible for the outer perimeter security of the alien task projects. If you attempt to get near the boundary of Area 51, you will meet Yellow Fruit. They will intimidate you. They will scare you. They will flash guns in your face on public land where you have every right to be, and they, most people, will go away, which is the prudent thing to do. Now, if you get to the boundary of Area 51 and put 1 foot across, you are now the property of Sea Spray. And no one who sees Sea Spray ever sees anyone else. Where do you think they get all this money? From drugs. If you look at all of the things that the secret teams have been doing, look at all of the covert operations that we've been performing, and then look at the budget for these things, and you will see that Congress has not even allotted 10% of the money that would be required to carry out what they have been doing. In the words of John Lear, whom I consider to be one of the greatest patriots in this country, "Wake up, America, you've been had." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Information at the back table. We have some tapes. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is our only source of income while we continue our research and do this, is the money that we get from people who come to listen to this information and the money, the sale of materials and tapes. When possible, when we have the extra money, we do make tapes which we give out to people for free with the stipulation that they never charge anyone for tapes and that they make at least 5 and pass them on to other people. If you purchase a tape from us, we want you to make copies and give them free to other people. If you purchase documents from us, we want you to copy those documents and give them free to other people. But we need your help. If you can afford it, please get the information. There's bibliography is attached to the documents, to the tapes. There's not. I want you to go research this material yourself. Start reading. Start looking into it. Don't believe what I'm telling you until you find evidence to support it in your own research. Then act. Do we still have some free tapes back there, Stan? There's still some free tapes. I don't know how many we've given out. Most of them already.
We have five left.
Okay. Also, anybody who wants to order a videotape of what happened tonight, who do they see? Who do they see to order tapes? Oh, Stan. See Mr. Barrington.
Make a check out,
okay,
and give it to Stan.
How much? It's right on the card. $25 for video, $10 for audio. Will you make a check payable to William Cooper? Thank you. I wish you all love, peace, happiness.
Thank you.
All right, please be truth seekers. Yes, sir. Now we'll take questions and answers. Yes, sir.
Got three short.
Okay.
The Eisenhower treat.
Oh, well, let me make this one statement first. When you consent to ask a question, you are consenting to have it included on the videotape. It is implied permission. Okay, I have to tell you that because the videotape is going to be disseminated to whoever wants it. Okay.
The Eisenhower treat. That was to accomplish what? Question one. That alien entity, is that one of the alien entities, or is that a representation of the total alien influence making the tree, or is it just one alien?
Okay, the question, ladies and gentlemen,
question,
was,
what are the alien projects?
He wants to know what the treaty was between Eisenhower and the alien nation that we made the treaty with. Number two, did the parties to the treaty include just one race, or were they representing all the different races of aliens? And what was the third question, sir?
What are the alien projects?
What are the alien projects? There's a lot of alien projects. The first question, the terms of the treaty were that we would keep their presence on Earth a secret. We would not interfere in their affairs. They would not interfere in our affairs, and we were particularly interested that they not interfere in anything that would affect our future. We were really interested in that point. Another term of the treaty was that they would furnish us with advanced technology. We would, in turn, allow them to abduct human beings on a limited periodic basis for medical examination and the monitoring of our development only. We have since over the years found out that they have gone way beyond that, way beyond it, and are doing, in fact, very terrible things to a select few human beings that are abducted all around the world. The third part of, or the second part of your question is, did they represent one race or all of the races of aliens? No, this group represented one specific race at the time that I saw the documents. We have evidence now that they may be also, they may have also entered into agreements with other races of aliens, and we do not know what the terms of those agreements, if indeed there are agreements, are. The answer to the third part of your question is there are many projects, and there are really too many to go into to answer one question, but there's projects to exchange technology. There's genetic engineering. There is mind control manipulation going on. There are test flight of the alien craft. There's a secret space program that has actually built a base on the moon and a colony on Mars. These exist. We have documents that can prove it. We have letters from people who participated in the projects. There is a book called We Discovered Alien Bases on the Moon, written by a man by the name of Fred Stetling, which includes actual photographs, NASA photographs, in that book that show the bases, that show the alien craft on the moon, that show the facilities in the craters, the domes, the spires, the structures. They are some of the exact same photographs which I viewed between 70 and 73, which were a part of a portfolio which made up the information that I saw. It does not include all of the photographs which I saw, but there's a pretty good representation there. God, I could go on and on and on. But the part, if you see someone, do you have a metaphysical bookstore in town? They should be able to find that book for you, whoever it is.
Who was the writer?
Fred Steckling.
I think that book's been out of print for about 10 years, hasn't it?
Oh, no, you can get it from Fred.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Is it possible to force an audit of the Federal Reserve?
She wants to know if it's possible to force an audit of the Federal Reserve. Yes, it is. It is not only possible, but it is happening. The momentum now is being gathered. A bill is being introduced into the Congress shortly to do exactly that, to audit the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has never been audited. If and when it is ever audited, this country's in for a rude awakening. Now, I suggest that you write your congressman to get behind this bill, insist that it be passed. Also include another paragraph insisting that they put another bill through Congress to nationalize the Federal Reserve, cancel the debt, and print our own money so that you can't owe yourself. The reason we owe somebody is because we're not printing our own money. They're printing it for us and loaning it to us, and it's not worth anything anyway. It's like me printing paper, giving it to you, and saying, you owe me your ranch, because I gave you some paper with my name on it. I mean, it's insane. It is. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And how we've stood for it all these years, I'll never know. And I'm just as much to blame as anyone else. Yes, ma'am.
Why was Nelson Rockefeller redeemed by whom?
Pardon?
Why was Nelson Rockefeller murdered?
Murder who?
Nelson Rockefeller.
Why was Nelson Rockefeller murdered? And by whom?
Why was he murdered? I never got up to that level to find out. I don't know.
Didn't he have a heart attack by injection?
I'm afraid that that is quite a normal way of getting rid of people nowadays.
Do you know anything about him?
I know an awful lot about Nelson Rockefeller, but I do not know why he was murdered. I do believe, though, as you do, obviously, that he was murdered.
Didn't Kissinger have something to do with that?
Henry Kissinger may have. Henry Kissinger was Rockefeller's man. Rockefeller bought Henry Kissinger back in 1953 when he gave him $50,000. From that moment on, Henry Kissinger belonged to Rockefeller. Yes.
You made the reference to air and water pollution.
Yes.
Do you have something to add to that as to...
I can add quite a bit to that. I was trying to dwell on the most important things. Now, that is an important issue, but people are catching on to that, and maybe they don't need to be prompted so much. But in 1957, due to the fact that we had discovered certain things were happening, and the aliens are able, obviously, to predict the future, they say, but we can't believe that because we don't know yet if they're predicting it correctly or not. But a large body of the most prominent scientists in the world met in Huntsville, Alabama in 1957 to study the matter, to study some of these questions we had from what the aliens had told us, specifically the benevolent aliens who were concerned about what we were doing to the Earth. They arrived at the conclusion that with or without predictions from anyone, by or shortly after the year 2000, the Earth would not be survivable, would not be able to exist here, simply because the projected increase in population, we would not be able to keep up with food supply for the masses of people. The burning of coal and fossil fuels would continue to pour carbon dioxide into the atmosphere along with other pollutants. The burning of sulfurous coal would increase the incidence of acid rain and destroy the forests. The forests are the only thing to keep the balance between oxygen and carbon dioxide. Since then, it's not just acid rain. we have been depleting the forests at an unbelievable rate. There's almost no rainforest left on the face of this planet now. The rate of pollution is unbelievable. At one point, we actually had rivers in this country that would burn if you lit a match anywhere near them. The whole length of the river would burn. It's incredible. There were whole rivers that were nothing but soap suds. We're getting better at doing that. But we've got to get even better and better. We've got to stop using fossil fuel. We've got to stop. We've got to do whatever it takes, even if it goes back to a simpler lifestyle. We've got to do that, simply because the Earth is a very fragile place. Does that answer your question, sir? Okay. The government, the elite have taken care of their own survival in case the Earth does so-called self-destruct. They have places that they can go. Yes, sir.
Is the catalytic converter one of the main contributors to acid rain because it puts out sulfur dioxide?
Absolutely.
Sulfur dioxide is mixed with moisture?
Yes, to get rid of one pollution, they create another one. It's because the only answer is to stop driving cars. That's the truth. And there is a benefit to horses, believe me. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Cooper, given the endangered condition of our planet, of which we're all painfully aware, what is your personal opinion as to the reason why these alien races want our planet?
I'm not sure that they want it. There's no evidence that they've attempted to take it from us. I think they want to live here with us. I think there's things here that they want. I think that they find us mystifying in certain ways. There are some aliens who do not have the ability to love or get angry. They don't have emotions. They are very goal-oriented, very scientific. They go about their business. They don't understand it when they get hurt. They don't understand it when they cry. They don't understand it when they love someone. And they seem to be studying that devoting a lot of attention to it for some reason. There are other ones who are just here to watch. They're not interfering in anything and won't interfere. They're just looking. They're just watching. They're just studying. They don't interfere with anybody. They don't bother anyone. There are some here doing, unfortunately, some bad things. Yes, sir, in the back.
A couple of questions. One might have already been answered. I'm wondering,
can you speak up, please?
How would the aliens fit in with a one world government? Is there any master plan that they have? And also, do we know really where they came from?
We know what they told us. For instance, the group we have the treaty with told us they came from a planet that revolves around a red star in the constellation of Orion, which we call Betelgeuse. Well, wherever they came from, before they came from where I'm going to tell you they came from, they really came from the planet Mars, and they may have come from somewhere else before that. But I know for a fact they came here from Mars. From Mars. We have found, ladies and gentlemen, the remains of an ancient civilization on the planet Mars that had at least reached the Bronze Age. And we have found that someone has been living underground on Mars. And I think it's these people who came here from Mars. The Mars phase is not something new. We knew about that on May 22nd, 1962, when our first space probe that we sent to Mars landed. Before it landed, it had made quite a few revolutions around the planet Mars in the atmosphere. It was a winged probe. It actually landed on the surface of the planet on May 22nd, 1962. Contrary to what you've been told, we knew and photographed the face on Mars, the pyramids, the remains of cities, and many, many other things at that time. I have a letter here in my briefcase that will confirm that. Yes, sir.
So you're confirming much of the alternative three scenario?
Alternative three is absolutely true. Now, in the book, you will find some misinformation because as they reveal these things to the public, they also put in things that can be proven false in case they ever want to renege on it. And you have to remember that the first purpose of the contingency plan known as Majestic was to test the reaction of the public to the truth with supposedly true information which could be proven false at a later date because false information is mixed in with it. Does everybody understand how that works? Yes, sir.
Is there any way to tell whether there are good aliens or bad aliens, or is there any way to contact or places to go where you can see them that are sick?
I can't take the responsibility of telling you who is good and who is bad because I can't make that determination. There's so much lies and so much deception mixed in with the good aliens and the bad aliens that I cannot determine who is who and what is what and what is a deception and what is reality. And I advise all of you to take extreme caution in making any kind of judgment because the bad ones will present themselves to you as being good to manipulate you. The good ones will lie to you to manipulate you to reach their ends, which they think is good for you. Some of them have a policy that they won't interfere with you no matter what. They just won't have anything to do with us. Now, somebody sent up a note that says, I am very concerned about the statement you made that there is deception coming from good and bad. What deception is coming from good ETs? Is this possibly a lack of spiritual understanding on your part? No, it's a part of in-depth investigation and questioning and finding out the truth rather than accepting what I hear and what I see. That is what is the result of. For instance, would you say that the good aliens who led the Jewish tribes out of Egypt were good or bad? Why? Didn't they save them? Didn't they lead them? Didn't they give them food? Didn't they give them water? But they saved them, didn't they? Didn't they save them? Wouldn't you say that was a good act? But how did they accomplish it? They deceived them. They said that they were God. The aliens that came to Earth in the ancient times told the people they were gods. Generally, they helped them, but they deceived them, they lied. I'm not capable of telling what's a lie and what's a deception, and I still believe in God. I still believe in Jesus. I'm a devout Christian. But I know that much of what is in the Bible is of alien origin because I have done my research, and it is without a doubt that much of our religious history is alien manipulation. I still believe in God. I still believe in Jesus Christ. I am still a Christian. I'm hanging on to my faith. Because I believe that they have used our faith and the truth in some way to manipulate us into whatever way they wanted us to go. I think they wanted to hasten our cultural and our civilization into a development in a right direction. But they did it by deceiving us, which is not good. The person who is deceived ultimately finds out that they have been deceived. When they find out they've been deceived, they ultimately hate the person that deceived them. And that is the ultimate end result of deception. Yes, ma'am?
I have a couple of things. I have a copy of what you're selling.
Uh-huh. Write a letter in your own handwriting expressing your own fears and concerns and then follow it with a phone call and demand an answer.
I told them that I wanted to answer.
You have to keep, you must continue doing that. As other people begin to do it with you, they are going to be forced to answer. I did the same thing you did. Only I sent 536 copies to every senator, every representative. I got six answers. Five of those answers said that they were sending the information in my letters to my congressman as a congressional courtesy. The sixth letter was from my congressman saying, I don't know what this is all about. I never received anything. Yes, ma'am.
And when I go to tell people about what you wrote, I mean, I want everyone here to know. I mean, I almost felt like I had an ulcer. Nobody would believe me. They told I was negative. What are you doing talking about this negative stuff to the planet? You're crazy. There's no aliens.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
No one knows about that better than myself and John Lear. We've been called kooks. We've been called mentally deranged. We have been laughed at. Would they make jokes about us on television and on radio? I don't care. I'm going to persist until we get results. The reason we're not getting results now is because you and I are the only ones writing. You and I. When he and she and he and he and her and she and everybody in here starts writing and their friends start writing and calling, then what do you think is going to happen? They're going to answer, but not until. Not until. That's why we need all of you with us. We need you marching right alongside of us. Ma'am, I care more about this country and the Constitution of the United States than I do about my life, because if they succeed in what they have planned for us, I would rather be dead. And also, I was raised that if you know you're right, you stand up and fight no matter what happens. No matter what happens. That's got to be done. John Wayne taught me that.
That's pretty far reaching now, though.
Yes, sir.
How many races are you aware of?
How many what?
Different races are you
aware of? I am only personally aware of four.
And what is it?
That's what's called the EVs. Along those grays, which came here from Mars, which we have a treaty with, the group called the Nordic and the group called the Orange.
At the time that our government made the contract with Along Those Grays, weren't they offered a alternative with a more, quote, benevolent
yes.
group? And
if you move into a new neighborhood, okay, and I belong to one gang and she belongs to another gang, she's a very nice-looking lady, isn't she? And she comes up and tells you, hey man, you moved into this neighborhood, watch out for old Bill over there. Bill's mean. But I'll help you, and I'll protect you. And I won't let Bill do anything to you, provided you get rid of all your knives and guns and don't ever lock your doors. What are you going to do?
I'm probably going to go with you.
There you go. See, I think they made the right decision when they turned down the initial offer, because they were faced with so many uncertainties and so many different things happening, and alien races from other planets. I mean, my God, I look at the technology that they have, and you want us to disarm? Are you got bats in your belfry? I think at that time, their decision was right. Their decision to self-direct the American people was wrong. Their decision to make a treaty with an alien race without the advice and consent of the Senate under the Constitution was wrong. It's illegal. Lying to the American people all these years, manipulating us, controlling us, literally ripping up the Constitution and putting it in Ollie North's shredder is wrong. All based upon an assumption that if we knew the truth, we would flip out. And that a small handful of men know better how to run this country than the people of this country do. And they are all part of a group who wants to subvert the Constitution in the first place to create a one-world economic system under a one-world government with a very few people at the top holding all the power and all the money, holding all the strength.
Just on the original alien intent.
The aliens planted those seeds, yes, over 250 years ago. Yes.
Has anyone ever gone
into those? Ma'am, with all due respect, we must stick to the most pressing problems at first. Right now, confronted with what we're confronted with, I can't be concerned with a hole at the pole. I'm very serious. Well, it may have something to do with it, but I'm not aware of anything. Yes.
talked earlier about a lot of people who've been abducted and have been implanted have moved away from their residence and or grouped together in other places. How do you see that fitting into the picture?
The people who have been abducted and implanted have some ultimate mission. We know that. They are compelled to move to certain places. Some of them are compelled to stay in the same place. When their mate, if they're married, resists, they leave their mate. That's how much they're compelled to do it. Well, there have been people who have left their children, women who have left their children, which is totally against the paternal instinct. The maternal instinct. It's just totally against it. Women just don't do that sort of thing. There's a level of mind control at work here that is terribly disconcerting. They are implanted, they have a specific goal to accomplish in the future, and most of them know that they have something that they're supposed to do, but they don't know what it is, and we don't either. The government is terribly afraid that when somebody pulls a switch sometime in the future, these abductees are going to go out and cripple the communications and blow up bridges and cripple the government. The government's afraid of this. I don't think that's what it's about. It may be what it's about, but it concerns me that the abductees are seeing an obvious criminal act as being a good thing. For instance, they're asleep in their bed. Someone comes and kidnaps them out of their bed. These people that kidnap them are so different than us that it's got to strike total fear into them. They are totally paralyzed, immobile. Now, most people have never been totally helpless in their life. And I'm telling you that that is the greatest terror that you will ever feel, is when you are totally helpless and you know it. Now, these people are taken into an alien environment in a craft that floats in the air. In a round room, and they all describe this room exactly the same, there is no difference between the descriptions. None of them know the other. Most of them have never heard of abductions or UFOs or spacecraft or aliens or anything. They've never read these books. And until just a few years ago, there weren't any books to read about abductions, because this is a recent thing that's been coming out. So we know that they're telling us the truth. We've hypnotically regressed them. We have tons of evidence and descriptions, and the stories are always the same. And spermanova is harvested from them. Scoops of flesh are taken out of their body, which leave pock marks. They are surgically operated upon. They are implanted. Some females are impregnated. After the end of the first trimester, they're abducted again and the fetus is taken from them. And the abductees perceive this experience as having been a good experience and no harm was done to them. Yet, and this is their conscious mind talking, listen to what their subconscious mind is telling them. Their subconscious mind is causing them to exhibit all of the same symptoms of a rape victim or a hostage victim who has been held for a long time, commonly called Patty Hearst syndrome, where you begin to identify with your captors. Now, this is obviously great physical and emotional and spiritual harm has been done to these people. Yet their mind has been controlled to the extent that they perceive this experience as having been a good one. That deeply concerns me. I don't know about you, but I'm really concerned about that. And they are and have been given some task to perform in the future. They know that they have this job to do. They don't know what it is they're supposed to do. Some of them have been given tremendous knowledge. Knowledge that they never possessed before, never learned in school, don't even know what it is that they know in a lot of instances. Yes, ma'am.
Each one here needs to know that we are sovereign beings under God and we have the right to say no.
That's right.
To invoke in the name of God that you don't want to be abducted, that you cannot take me against my free will. And if you find yourself unable to speak in such a situation, mentally make that declaration. They cannot take you under universal law.
What she's saying is true, and people who have done that and really believed in what they were saying have not been abducted. People who have tried to pull that off and really didn't believe what they were saying were taken anyway.
The implantation, is it physical or psychological?
It's physical. It has been detected and proven to exist by magnetic resonance imaging. You do need, when you're checking this, to find the implants, you do need a medical doctor or a surgeon who is adept at finding small foreign objects in the human body, such as a physician who gained experience in the Vietnam War locating small shrapnel fragments in the human body and removing them. They are the ones who can find these implants the quickest. Yes, many of them have been found. An Audi automobile, license number LAMER, is blocking. Need to move that automobile. Yes, sir. Yellow shirt.
Yeah. What about transfers of technology? You know, it strikes me that the government, everybody, be interested in these technologies down the road. You know.
You use a lot of it every day.
Okay, a lot of it's already transferred.
A lot of it is filtered out from the national laboratories into the defense industrial complex and then out to the public.
Are they working on other, you read about power sources for this thing, their air engines and water engines, are they working on that to stop the air pollution?
They are not working on anything until the oil is gone. The oil companies are owned by, guess who? Yes, sir.
What do you have, a couple things, what do you have to say on the Pleiades? And also, has there been any discoveries of aliens that look exactly like people?
Yes, the Nordic and the Orient both look like people.
I mean, you couldn't tell from one person.
No, I wouldn't go that far. They look enough that they could pass if they want to. And the Nordic are described as being very beautiful. Very beautiful people, blue eyes, blonde hair.
Where do they come from?
The Nordic? I don't know where they come from.
All right. Well, about the Pleiades.
Where do you come from? That is the
What's the average like?
Ladies and gentlemen, he brought up a good point. I wanted to know about the Pleiades group. I want to tell you right now that the Billy Myers case is a real case. It's not a phony case. It is not a hoax. It is real. It is absolutely real. The documents that you saw with the string in it, all of that was prepared by the Office of Naval Intelligence. The model was built and placed in his barn, and photographers were sent up there with intelligence agents who opened the barn door and said, see, the Billy Myers case is real. The Pleiadian people are real. The craft are real. Some of their craft we have at Area 51 and are flying them. I have on videotape right now with me here tonight, if you want me to, I can show it to you.
Yes.
Evidence right before your very eyes that will prove to you that these craft on this videotape are real. And you can see for yourself, there's no way possible that these photographs can be.